electricity, and you got rid of the enemies. At the bottom I had written, "The electricity is fucking up your thinking about these things, Reg. Interference with brain waves. Does your wife have a blender?" In effect, you had started writing letters to the paper, the writer said. "Yes. I wrote that letter on a Friday night. On Saturday morning I got up around 11, hungover and only blurrily aware of what sort of mischief I'd been up to the night before. Great pangs of shame as I plugged everything back in. Greater pangs of shame and fear when I saw what I'd written to Reg. I looked all over the house for the original to that letter, hoping like hell I hadn't mailed it, but I had. And the way I got through that day was by making a resolution to take my lumps like a man and go on the wagon. Sure I was." The following Wednesday there was a letter from Reg. One page, handwritten. Fornit somme fornus, doodles all over it. In the center, just this: "You were right. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Reg, you were right. Everything is fine now. Reg. Thanks a lot. Reg. Fornit is fine. Reg. Thanks. Reg." "Oh, my," the writer's wife said. "Bet his wife was mad," the agent's wife said. "But she wasn't, because it worked." "Worked?" the agent said. "It got my letter in the Monday Morning Post. Monday afternoon he went down to the local power company office and told them to cut his power off. Jane Thorpe, of course, was hysterical. Her range ran on electricity. She did indeed have a blender, a sewing machine, a washer-dryer combination. Well, you understand. On Monday evening I'm sure she was ready to have my head on a plate. But it was Reg's behavior that made her decide I was a miracle worker instead of a lunatic. He sat her down in the living room and talked to her quite rationally. He said that he knew he'd been acting in a peculiar fashion. He knew that she'd been worried. He told her that he felt much better with the power off, and that he would be glad to help her through any inconvenience that it caused. And then he suggested that they go next door and say hello. Not to the KGB agents with the radium in their van," the writer asked. "Yes, to them. Jane was totally floored. She agreed to go over with him, but she told me that she was girding herself up for a really nasty scene. Accusations, threats, hysteria. She had begun to consider leaving Reg if he wouldn't get help for his problem. She told me that Wednesday morning on the phone that she had made herself a promise. The power was the next to last straw. One more thing and she was going to leave for New York. She was becoming afraid, you see. The thing had worsened by such degrees as to be nearly imperceptible. And she loved him. But even for her it had gotten as far as it could go. She had decided that if Reg said one strange word to the students next door, she was going to break up housekeeping. I found out much later that she had already asked some very circumspect questions about the procedure in Nebraska to effect an involuntary committal." "The poor woman," the writer's wife murmured. "But the evening was a smashing success," the editor said. "Reg was at his most charming, and according to Jane that was very charming indeed. She hadn't seen him on so much in 3 years. The sullenness, the secretiveness, they were gone. The nervous tics, the involuntary jump and look over his shoulder whenever a door opened. He had a beer and talked about all the topics that were current back in those dim, dead days, the war, the possibilities of a volunteer army, the riots in the cities, the pot laws. The fact that he had written underworld figures came up, and they were author-struck, was the way Jane put it. 3 of the 4 had read it, and you can bet the odd one wasn't going to linger any on his way to the library." The writer laughed and nodded. He knew about that bit. "So," the editor said, "we leave Reg Thorpe and his wife for just a little while, without electrical power, but happier than they've been in a good long time." "Good thing he didn't have an IBM typewriter," the agent said. "And return to ye editor." 2 weeks have gone by. Summer is ending. Ye editor has, of course, fallen off the wagon any number of times, but has managed on the whole to remain pretty respectable. The days have gone their appointed rounds. At Cape Kennedy they are getting ready to put a man on the moon. The new issue of Logan's, with John Lindsay on the cover, is out on the stands, and selling miserably as usual. I had put in a purchase order for a short story called The Ballad of the Flexible Bullet by Reg Thorpe, First Serial Rights, proposed publication January 1970, proposed purchase price $800, which was standard then for a Logan's lead story. I got a buzz from my superior, Jim Dowagan. Could I come up and see him? I trotted into his office at 10 in the morning, looking and feeling my very best. It didn't occur to me until later that Janie Morrison, his secretary, looked like a wake in progress. I sat down and asked Jim what I could do for him, or vice versa. I won't say the Reg Thorpe name hadn't entered my mind. Having the story was a tremendous coup for Logan's, and I suspected a few congratulations were in order. So you can imagine how dumbfounded I was when he slid two purchase orders across the desk at me. The Thorpe story and a John Updike novella we had scheduled as the February fiction lead. Return stamped across both. I looked at the revoked purchase orders. I looked at Jimmy. I couldn't make any of it out. I really couldn't get my brains to work over what it meant. There was a block in there. I looked around and I saw his hot plate. Janie brought it in for him every morning when she came to work and plugged it in so he could have fresh coffee when he wanted it. That had been the drill at Logan's for 3 years or more, and that morning all I could think was, if that thing was unplugged, I could think. I know if that thing was unplugged, I could put this together. I said, "What's this, Jim?" "I'm sorry as hell to have to be the one to tell you this, Henry," he said. "Logan's isn't going to be publishing any more fiction as of January 1970. The editor paused to get a cigarette, but his pack was empty. "Does anyone have a cigarette?" The writer's wife gave him a Salem. "Thank you, Meg." He lit it, shook out the match, and dragged deep. The coal glowed mellowly in the dark. "Well," he said, "I'm sure Jim thought I was crazy." I said, "Do you mind?" and leaned over and pulled the plug on his hot plate. His mouth dropped open, and he said, "What the hell, Henry?" "It's hard for me to think with things like that going," I said. "Interference." And it really seemed to be true, because with the plug pulled, I was able to see the situation a great deal more clearly. "Does this mean I'm pinked?" I asked him. "I don't know," he said. "That's up to Sam and the board. I just don't know, Henry." There were a lot of things I could have said. I guess what Jimmy was expecting was a passionate plea for my job. You know that saying, "he had his ass out to the wind"? I maintain that you don't understand the meaning of that phrase until you're the head of a suddenly non-existent department. But I didn't plead my cause, or the cause of fiction at Logan's. I pleaded for Reg Thorpe's story. First, I said that we could move it up over the deadline, put it in the December issue. Jimmy said, "Come on, Henry, the December issue is locked up, you know that, and we're talking 10,000 words here." 9,008, I said. "And a full-page illo," he said. "Forget it." "Well, we'll scrap the art," I said. "Listen, Jimmy, it's a great story. Maybe the best fiction we've had in the last 5 years. Jimmy said, "I read it, Henry. I know it's a great story, but we just can't do it. Not in December. It's Christmas, for God's sake. And you want to put a story about a guy who kills his wife and kid under the Christmas trees of America? You must be..." He stopped right there, but I saw him glance over at his hot plate. "He might as well have said it out loud, you know." The writer nodded slowly, his eyes never leaving the dark shadow that was the editor's face. I started to get a headache. Very small headache at first. It was getting hard to think again. I remembered that Janie Morrison had an electric pencil sharpener on her desk. There were all those fluorescents in Jim's office, the heaters, the vending machines in the concession down the hall. When you stop to think of it, the whole fucking building ran on electricity. It was a wonder that anyone could get anything done. That was when the idea began to creep in, I think. The idea that Logan's was going broke because no one could think straight. And the reason no one could think straight was because we were all cooped up in this high-rise building that ran on electricity. Our brain waves were completely messed up. I remember thinking that if you could have gotten a doctor in there with one of those EEG machines, they'd get some awfully weird graphs, full of those big, spiky alpha waves that characterize malignant tumors in the forebrain. Just thinking about those things made my headache worse. But I gave it one more try. I asked him if he would at least ask Sam Vadar, the editor-in-chief, to let the story stand in the January issue, as Logan's fiction valedictory, if necessary, the final Logan short story. Jimmy was fiddling with a pencil and nodding. He said, "I'll bring it up, but you know it's not going to fly. We've got a story by a one-shot novelist, and we got a story by John Updike that's just as good, maybe better, and..." "The Updike story is not better," I said. "Well, Jesus, Henry, you don't have to shout." "I am not shouting," I shouted. He looked at me for a long time. My headache was quite bad by then. I could hear the fluorescents buzzing away. They sounded like a bunch of flies caught in a bottle. It was a really hateful sound, and I thought I could hear Janie running her electric pencil sharpener. "They're doing it on purpose," I thought. "They want to mess me up. They know I can't think of the right things to say while those things are running, so... Jim was saying something about bringing it up at the next editorial meeting, suggesting that instead of an arbitrary cutoff date, they publish all the stories which I had verbally contracted for. Although, I got up, went across the room, and shut off the lights. "What did you do that for?" Jimmy asked. "You know why I did it," I said. "You ought to get out of here, Jimmy, before there's nothing left of you." He got up and came over to me. "I think you ought to take the rest of the day off, Henry," he said. "Go home. Rest. I know you've been under a strain lately. I want you to know I'll do the best I can on this. I feel as strongly as you do. Well, almost as strongly. But you ought to just go home and put your feet up and watch some TV. "TV," I said, and laughed. It was the funniest thing I'd ever heard. "Jimmy," I said, "you tell Sam Vadar something else for me." "What's that, Henry?" "Tell him he needs a Fornet. This whole outfit. One Fornet, a dozen of them." "A Fornet," he said, nodding. "Okay, Henry, I'll be sure to tell him that." My headache was very bad. I could hardly even see. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I was already wondering how I was going to tell Reg and wondering how Reg was going to take it. "I'll put in the purchase order myself if I can find out who to send it to," I said. "Reg might have some ideas. A dozen Fornets. Get him to dust this place with Fornets from end to end. Shut off the fucking power, all of it." I was walking around his office, and Jimmy was staring at me with his mouth open. "Shut off all the power, Jimmy. You tell him that. Tell Sam that. No one can think with all that electrical interference. Am I right?" "You're right, Henry, 100%. You just go on home and get some rest, okay? Take a nap or something. And Fornets! They don't like all that interference. Radium, electricity, it's all the same thing. Feed them bologna, cake, peanut butter. Can we get requisitions for that stuff?" My headache was this black ball of pain behind my eyes. I was seeing two of Jimmy, two of everything. All of a sudden I needed a drink. If there was no Fornus and the rational side of my mind assured me there was not, then a drink was the only thing in the world that would get me right. "Sure, we can get the requisitions," he said. "You don't believe any of this, do you, Jimmy?" I asked. "Sure I do. It's okay. You just want to go home and rest a little while." "You don't believe it now," I said, "but maybe you will when this rag goes into bankruptcy. How in the name of God can you believe you're making rational decisions when you're sitting less than 15 yards from a bunch of Coke machines and candy machines and sandwich machines?" Then I really had a terrible thought. "And a microwave oven," I screamed at him. "They got a microwave oven to heat their sandwiches up in." Well, he started to say something, but I didn't pay any attention. I ran out. Thinking of that microwave oven explained everything. I had to get away from it. That was what made the headache so bad. I remember seeing Janie and Kate Younger from the ad department and Mert Strong from publicity in the outer office, all of them staring at me. They must have heard me shouting. My office was on the floor just below. I took the stairs. I went into my office, turned off all the lights, and got my briefcase. I took the elevator down to the lobby, but I put my briefcase between my feet and poked my fingers in my ears. I also remember the other three or four people in the elevator looking at me rather strangely. The editor uttered a dry chuckle. They were scared, so to speak. Cooped up in a little moving box with an obvious madman, you would have been scared too. "Oh, surely, that's a little strong," the agent's wife said. "Not at all. Madness has to start somewhere. If this story's about anything, if events in one's own life can ever be said to be about anything, then this is a story about the genesis of insanity. Madness has to start somewhere, and it has to go somewhere, like a road or a bullet from the barrel of a gun. I was still miles behind Reg Thorpe, but I was over the line, you bet. I had to go somewhere, so I went to Four Fathers, a bar on 49th. I remember picking that bar specifically because there was no juke and no color TV and not many lights. I remember ordering the first drink. After that, I don't remember anything until I woke up the next day in my bed at home. There was puke on the floor and a very large cigarette burn in the sheet over me. In my stupor I had apparently escaped dying in one of two extremely nasty ways, choking or burning. Not that I probably would have felt either.
Jesus, the agent said, almost respectfully.
It was a blackout, the editor said. The first real bona fide blackout of my life. But they're always a sign of the end, and you never have very many. One way or another, you never have very many. But any alcoholic will tell you that a blackout isn't the same as passing out. It would save a lot of trouble if it was. No, when an alky blacks out, he keeps doing things. An alky in a blackout is a busy little devil, sort of like a malign fornit. He'll call up his ex-wife and abuse her over the phone, or drive his car the wrong way on the turnpike and wipe out a carload of kids. He'll quit his job, rob a market, give away his wedding ring. Busy little devils. What I had done, apparently, was to come home and write a letter. Only this one wasn't to Reg. It was to me. And I didn't write it. At least according to the letter, I didn't.
Who did? The writer's wife asked.
Bellis.
Who's Bellis?
His fornit, the writer said almost absently. His eyes were shadowy and far away.
Yes, that's right, the editor said, not looking a bit surprised. He made the letter in the sweet night air for them again, indenting at the proper points with his finger.
Hello from Bellis. I am sorry for your problems, my friend, but would like to point out at the start that you are not the only one with problems. This is no easy job for me. I can dust your damn machine with foreigners from now into forever, but moving the keys is supposed to be your job. That's what God made big people for. So I sympathize, but that's all of the sympathy you get. I understand you worry about Reg Thorpe. I worry not about Thorpe, but my brother, Rackney. Thorpe worries about what will happen to him if Rackney leaves, but only because he is selfish. The curse of serving writers is that they are all selfish. He worries not about what will happen to Rackney if Thorpe leaves, or goes El Bonzo Sico. Those things have apparently never crossed his oh-so-sensitive mind. But luckily for us, all our unfortunate problems have the same short-term solution, and so I strain my arms and my tiny body to give it to you, my drunken friend. You may wonder about long-term solutions. I assure you there are none. All wounds are mortal. Take what's given. You sometimes get a little slack in the rope, but the rope always has an end. So what? Bless the slack and don't waste breath cursing the drop. A grateful heart knows that in the end we all swing. You must pay him for the story yourself, but not with a personal check. Thorpe's mental problems are severe and perhaps dangerous, but this in no way indicates stupidity.
The editor stopped here and spelled S-T-U-P-I-D-D-I-T-Y. Then he went on.
If you give him a personal check, he'll crack wise in about 9 seconds. Withdraw $800 and some few odd from your personal account and have your bank open a new account for you in the name Arvin Publishing Incorporated. Make sure they understand you want checks that look businesslike. Nothing with cute dogs or canyon vistas on them. Find a friend, someone you can trust, and list him as co-drawer. When the checks arrive, make one for $800 and have the co-drawer sign the check. Send the check to Reg Thorpe. That will cover your ass for the time being. Over and out. It was signed Bellis. Not in holograph, in type.
Phew, the writer said again.
When I got up, the first thing I noticed was the typewriter. It looked like somebody had made it up as a ghost typewriter in a cheap movie. The day before, it was an old black office Underwood. When I got up, with a head that felt about the size of North Dakota, it was sort of gray. The last few sentences of the letter were clumped up and faded. I took one look and figured my faithful old Underwood was probably finished. I took a taste and went out into the kitchen. There was an open bag of confectioner's sugar on the counter with a scoop in it. There was confectioner's sugar everywhere between the kitchen and the little den where I did my work in those days.
Feeding your fornit, the writer said. Bellis had a sweet tooth. You thought so, anyway.
Yes. But even as sick and hungover as I was, I knew perfectly well who the fornit was.
He ticked off the points on his fingers.
First, Bellis was my mother's maiden name. Second, that phrase El Bonzo Sico. It was a private phrase my brother and I used to mean crazy back when we were kids.
Third, and in a way most damning, was that spelling of the word stupidity. It's one of those words I habitually misspell. I had an almost screamingly literate writer once who used to spell refrigerator with a D. Refrigerator, no matter how many times the copy editors blooped it. And for this guy who had a doctoral degree from Princeton, ugly was always going to be U-G-H-L-Y. The writer's wife uttered a sudden laugh. It was both embarrassed and cheerful. I do that. All I'm saying is that a man's misspellings, or a woman's, are his literary fingerprints. Ask any copy editor who has done the same writer a few times. No, Bellis was me, and I was Bellis. Yet the advice was damn good advice. In fact, I thought it was great advice, but here's something else. The subconscious leaves its fingerprints, but there's a stranger down there, too. A hell of a weird guy who knows a hell of a lot. I'd never seen that phrase, co-drawer, in my life, to the best of my knowledge, but there it was, and it was a good one, and I found out sometime later that banks actually use it. I picked up the phone to call a friend of mine, and this bolt of pain, incredible, went through my head. I thought of Reg Thorpe and his radium and put the phone down in a hurry. I went to see the friend in person after I'd taken a shower and gotten a shave and had checked myself about 9 times in the mirror to make sure my appearance approximated how a rational human being is supposed to look. Even so, he asked me a lot of questions and looked me over pretty closely. So I guess there must have been a few signs that a shower, a shave, and a good dose of Listerine couldn't hide. He wasn't in the biz, and that was a help. News has a way of traveling, you know, in the biz, so to speak. Also, if he'd been in the biz, he would have known Arvin Publishing Incorporated was responsible for Logan's, and would have wondered just what sort of scam I was trying to pull. But he wasn't. He didn't. And I was able to tell him it was a self-publishing venture I was interested in since Logan's had apparently decided to 86 the fiction department.
Did he ask you why you were calling it Arvin Publishing? The writer asked.
Yes.
What did you tell him?
I told him, the editor said, smiling a wintry smile, that Arvin was my mother's maiden name.
There was a little pause, and then the editor resumed. He spoke almost uninterrupted to the end.
So I began waiting for the printed checks, of which I wanted exactly one. My exercise to pass the time. You know, pick up the glass, flex the elbow, empty the glass, flex the elbow again. Until all that exercise wears you out and you just sort of fall forward with your head on the table. Other things happened, but those were the ones that really occupied my mind, the waiting and the flexing, as I remember. I have to reiterate that because I was drunk a lot of the time, and for every single thing I remember, there are probably 50 or 60 I don't. I quit my job. That caused a sigh of relief all around, I'm sure. From them, because they didn't have to perform the existential task of firing me for craziness from a department that was no longer in existence. Me, because I didn't think I could ever face that building again. The elevator, the fluorescence, the phones, the thought of all that waiting electricity. I wrote Reg Thorpe and his wife a couple of letters each during that 3-week period. I remember doing hers, but not his. Like the letter from Bellis, I wrote those letters in blackout periods. But I hewed to my old work habits when I was blotto, just as I hewed to my old misspellings. I never failed to use a carbon, and when I came to the next morning, the carbons were lying around. It was like reading letters from a stranger. Not that the letters were crazy, not at all. The one where I finished up with a P.S. about the blender was a lot worse. These letters seemed almost reasonable.
He stopped and shook his head slowly and wearily.
Poor Jane Thorpe. Not that things appeared to be all that bad at their end. It must have seemed to her that her husband's editor was doing a very skillful and humane job of humoring him out of his deepening depression. The question of whether or not it's a good idea to humor a person who has been entertaining all sorts of paranoid fantasies, fantasies which almost led, in one case, to an actual assault on a little girl, probably occurred to her. If so, she chose to ignore the negative aspects because she was humoring him too. Nor have I ever blamed her for it. He wasn't just a meal ticket, some nag that was to be worked and humored, humored and worked until he was ready for the knacker's shop. She loved the guy. In her own special way, Jane Thorpe was a great lady. And after living with Reg from the early times to the high times and finally to the crazy times,
I think she would have agreed with Bellis about blessing the slack and not wasting your breath cursing the drop. Of course, the more slack you get, the harder you snap when you finally fetch up at the end. But even that quick snap can be a blessing, I reckon. Who wants to strangle? I had returned letters from both of them in that short period. Remarkably sunny letters. Although there was a strange, almost final quality to that sunlight, it seemed as if... Well, never mind the cheap philosophy. If I can think of what I mean, I'll say it. Let it go for now. He was playing hearts with the kids next door every night, and by the time the leaves started to fall, they thought Reg Thorpe was just about God come down to earth. When they weren't playing cards or tossing a frisbee, they were talking literature, with Reg gently rallying them through their paces. He'd gotten a puppy from the local animal shelter and walked it every morning and night, meeting other people on the block the way you do when you walk your mutt. People who decided the Thorpes were really very peculiar people now began to change their minds. When Jane suggested that without electrical appliances she could really use a little house help, Reg agreed at once. She was flabbergasted by his cheery acceptance of the idea. It wasn't a question of money. After underworld figures, they were rolling in dough. It was a question, Jane figured, of they. They were everywhere. That was Reg's scripture. And what better agent for they than a cleaning woman that went everywhere in your house, looked under beds and in closets and probably in desk drawers as well, if they weren't locked and then nailed shut for good measure. But he told her to go right ahead. Told her he felt like an insensitive clod not to have thought of it earlier, even though, she made a point of telling me this, he was doing most of the heavy chores, such as the hand-washing himself. He only made one small request, that the woman not be allowed to come into his study. Best of all, most encouraging of all from Jane's standpoint, was the fact that Reg had gone back to work, this time on a new novel. She had read the first three chapters and thought they were marvelous. All of this, she said, had begun when I had accepted The Ballad of the Flexible Bullet for Logan's. The period before that had been dead low ebb, and she blessed me for it. I am sure she really meant that last, but her blessing seemed to have no great warmth, and the sunniness of her letter was marred somehow. Here we are, back to that. The sunshine in her letter was like sunshine on a day when you see those mackerel-scale clouds that mean it's going to rain like hell soon. All this good news, hearts and dog and cleaning woman and new novel, and yet she was too intelligent to really believe he was getting well again, or so I believed, even in my own fog. Reg had been exhibiting symptoms of psychosis. Psychosis is like lung cancer in one way. Neither one of them clears up on its own, although both cancer patients and lunatics may have their good days. May I borrow another cigarette, dear? The writer's wife gave him one. After all, he resumed, bringing out the Ronson, the signs of his idée fixe were all around her. No phone, no electricity. He'd put Reynolds wrap over all the switch plates. He was putting food in his typewriter as regularly as he put it into the new puppy's dish. The students next door thought he was a great guy, but the students next door didn't see Reg putting on rubber gloves to pick up the newspaper off the front stoop in the morning because of his radiation fears. They didn't hear him moaning in his sleep or have to soothe him when he woke up screaming with dreadful nightmares he couldn't remember. You, my dear, he turned toward the writer's wife, have been wondering why she stuck with him. Although you haven't said as much, it's been on your mind, am I right? She nodded. Yes. And I'm not going to offer a long, motivational thesis. The convenient thing about stories that are true is that you only need to say this is what happened and let people worry for themselves about the why. Generally, nobody ever knows why things happen anyway, particularly the ones who say they do. But in terms of Jane Thorpe's own selective perception, things had gotten one hell of a lot better. She interviewed a middle-aged black woman about the cleaning job and brought herself to speak as frankly as she could about her husband's idiosyncrasies. The woman, Gertrude Rulin by name, laughed and said she'd done for people who were a whole lot stranger. Jane spent the first week of the Rulin woman's employ pretty much the way she'd spent that first visit with the young people next door, waiting for some crazy outburst. But Reg charmed her as completely as he'd charmed the kids, talking about her church work, her husband, and her youngest son, Jimmy, who, according to Gertrude, made Dennis the Menace look like the biggest bore in the first grade. She'd had 11 children in all, but there was a 9-year gap between Jimmy and his next oldest sib. He made things hard on her. Reg seemed to be getting well, at least if you looked at things a certain way he did. But he was just as crazy as ever, of course, and so was I. Madness may well be a sort of flexible bullet, but any ballistics expert worth his salt will tell you no two bullets are exactly the same. Reg's one letter to me talked a little bit about his new novel and then passed directly to Fornitz. Fornitz in general, Rackney in particular. He speculated on whether they actually wanted to kill Fornitz, or, he thought this more likely, capture them alive and study them. He closed by saying, "Both my appetite and my outlook on life have improved immeasurably since we began our correspondence, Henry. Appreciate it all. Affectionately yours, Reg." And a P.S. below, inquiring casually if an illustrator had been assigned to do his story. That caused a guilty pang or two and a quick trip to the liquor cabinet on my part. Reg was into Fornitz. I was into wires. My answering letter mentioned Fornitz only in passing. By then I really was humoring the man, at least on that subject. An elf with my mother's maiden name and my own bad spelling habits didn't interest me a whole hell of a lot. What had come to interest me more and more was the subject of electricity and microwaves and RF waves and RF interference from small appliances and low-level radiation and Christ knows what else. I went to the library and took out books on the subject. I bought books on the subject. There was a lot of scary stuff in them. And, of course, that was just the sort of stuff I was looking for. I had my phone taken out and my electricity turned off. It helped for a while, but one night when I was staggering in the door, drunk with a bottle of black velvet in my hand and another one in my topcoat pocket, I saw this little red eye peeping down at me from the ceiling. God, for a minute I thought I was going to have a heart attack. It looked like a bug up there at first, a great, big, dark bug with one glowing eye. I had a Coleman gas lantern and I lit it. Saw what it was at once. Only instead of relieving me, it made me feel worse. As soon as I got a good look at it, it seemed I could feel large, clear bursts of pain going through my head, like radio waves. For a moment, it was as if my eyes had rotated in their sockets, and I could look into my own brain and see cells in there smoking, going black, dying. It was a smoke detector, a gadget which was even newer than microwave ovens back in 1969. I bolted out of the apartment and went downstairs. I was on the fifth floor, but by then I was always taking the stairs, and hammered on the super's door. I told him I wanted that thing out of there, wanted it out of there right away, wanted it out of there tonight, wanted it out of there within the hour. He looked at me as though I'd gone completely, you should pardon the expression, bonzo seco, and I can understand that now. That smoke detector was supposed to make me feel good. It was supposed to make me feel safe. Now, of course, they're the law, but back then it was a great leap forward, paid for by the Building Tenants Association. He removed it. It didn't take long. But the look in his eyes was not lost upon me, and I could, in some limited way, understand his feelings. I needed a shave. I stank of whiskey. My hair was sticking up all over my head. My topcoat was dirty. He would know I no longer went to work, that I'd had my television taken away, that my phone and electrical service had been voluntarily interrupted. He thought I was crazy. I may have been crazy, but, like Reg, I was not stupid. I turned on the charm. Editors have got to have a certain amount, you know, and I greased the skids with a $10 bill. Finally, I was able to smooth things over. But I knew from the way people were looking at me in the next couple of weeks, my last 2 weeks in the building, as things turned out, that the story had traveled. The fact that no members of the Tenants Association approached me to make wounded noises about my ingratitude was particularly telling. I suppose they thought I might take after them with a steak knife. All of that was very secondary in my thoughts that evening, however. I sat in the glow of the Coleman lantern, the only light in the three rooms except for all the electricity in Manhattan that came through the windows. I sat with a bottle in one hand, a cigarette in the other, looking at the plate in the ceiling where the smoke detector with its single red eye, an eye which was so unobtrusive in the daytime that I had never even noticed it had been. I thought of the undeniable fact that, although I'd had all the electricity turned off in my place, there had been that one live item, and where there was one, there might be more. Even if there wasn't, the whole building was rotten with wires. It was filled with wires, the way a man dying of cancer is filled with those evil cells and rotting organs. Closing my eyes, I could see all those wires in the darkness of their conduits glowing with a sort of green, nether light. And beyond them, the entire city. One wire, almost harmless in itself, running to a switchplate. The wire behind the switchplate, a little thicker, leading down through a conduit to the basement, where it joined a still thicker wire. That one leading down under the street to a whole bundle of wires, only those wires so thick that they were really cables. When I got Jane Thorpe's letter mentioning the tinfoil, part of my mind recognized that she saw it as a sign of Reg's craziness. And that part knew I would have to respond as if my whole mind thought she was right. The other part of my mind, by far the largest part now, thought, what a marvelous idea! And I covered my own switchplates in identical fashion the very next day. I was the man, remember, that was supposed to be helping Reg Thorpe. In a desperate sort of way, it's actually quite funny. I determined that night to leave Manhattan. There was an old family place in the Adirondacks I could go to, and that sounded fine to me. The one thing keeping me in the city was Reg Thorpe's story. If the Ballad of the Flexible Bullet was Reg's life ring in a sea of madness, it was mine, too. I wanted to place it in a good magazine. With that done, I could get the hell out. So, that's where the not-so-famous Wilson Thorpe correspondent stood just before the shit hit the fan. We were like a couple of dying drug addicts comparing the relative merits of heroin and lewds. Reg had Fornits in his typewriter, I had Fornits in the walls, and both of us had Fornits in our heads. And there was they. Don't forget they. I hadn't been flogging the story around for long before deciding they included every magazine fiction editor in New York. Not that there were many by the fall of 1969. If you'd grouped them together, you could have killed the whole bunch of them with one shotgun shell, and before long I started to feel that was a damn good idea. It took about 5 years before I could see it from their perspective. I'd upset the super, and he was just a guy who saw me when the heat was screwed up and when it was time for his Christmas tip. These other guys, well, the irony was just that a lot of them really were my friends. Jared Baker was the assistant fiction editor at Esquire in those days, and Jared and I were in the same rifle company during World War II, for instance. These guys weren't just uneasy after sampling the new improved Henry Wilson. They were appalled. If I just sent the story around with a pleasant covering letter explaining the situation, my version of it anyway, I probably would have sold the Thorpe story almost right away. But, oh no, that wasn't good enough. Not for this story. I was going to see that this story got the personal treatment. So I went from door to door with it, a stinking, grizzled ex-editor with shaking hands and red eyes and a big old bruise on his left cheekbone from where he ran into the bathroom door on the way to the can in the dark 2 nights before. I might as well have been wearing a sign reading Bellevue Bound. Nor did I want to talk to these guys in their offices. In fact, I could not. The time had long since passed when I could get into an elevator and ride it up 40 floors. So I met them like pushers meet junkies, in parks, on steps, or in the case of Jared Baker, in a burger heaven on 49th Street. Jared, at least, would have been delighted to buy me a decent meal, but the time had passed, you understand, when any self-respecting maitre d' would have let me in a restaurant where they serve business people. The agent winced. I got perfunctory promises to read the story, followed by concerned questions about how I was, how much I was drinking. I remember, hazily, trying to tell a couple of them about how electricity and radiation leaks were fucking up everyone's thinking. And when Andy Rivers, who edited fiction for American Crossing, suggested I ought to get some help, I told him he was the one who ought to get some help. You see those people out there on the street? I said. We were standing in Washington Square Park. Half of them, maybe even three-quarters of them, have got brain tumors. I wouldn't sell you Thorpe's story on a bet, Andy. Hell, you couldn't understand it in this city. Your brain's in the electric chair and you don't even know it. I had a copy of the story in my hand, rolled up like a newspaper. I whacked him on the nose with it, the way you'd whack a dog for piddling in the corner. Then I walked off. I remember him yelling for me to come back, something about having a cup of coffee and talking it over some more. And then I passed a discount record store with loudspeakers blasting heavy metal onto the sidewalk and banks of snowy cold fluorescent lights inside, and I lost his voice in a kind of deep buzzing sound inside my head. I remember thinking two things. I had to get out of the city soon, very soon, or I would be nursing a brain tumor of my own, and I had to get a drink right away. That night, when I got back to my apartment, I found a note under the door. It said, "We want you out of here, you crazy bird." I threw it away without so much as a second thought. We veteran crazy birds have more important things to worry about than anonymous notes from fellow tenants. I was thinking over what I'd said to Andy Rivers about Reg's story. The more I thought about it, and the more drinks I had, the more sense it made. Flexible Bullet was funny, and on the surface it was easy to follow. But below that surface level, it was surprisingly complex. Did I really think another editor in the city could grasp the story on all levels? Maybe once. But did I still think so now that my eyes had been opened? Did I really think there was room for appreciation and understanding in a place that was wired up like a terrorist's bomb? God, loose vaults were leaking out everywhere. I read the paper while there was still enough daylight to do so, trying to forget the whole wretched business for a while. And there, on page one of the Times, there was a story about how radioactive material from nuclear power plants kept disappearing. The article went on to theorize that enough of that stuff in the right hands could quite easily be used to make a very dirty nuclear weapon. I sat there at the kitchen table as the sun went down, and in my mind's eye I could see them panning for plutonium dust like 1849 miners panning for gold. Only they didn't want to blow up the city with it. Oh, no. They just wanted to sprinkle it around and fuck up everyone's minds. They were the bad Fornets. And all that radioactive dust was Bad Luck Fornus, the worst Bad Luck Fornus of all time. I decided I didn't want to sell Reg's story after all, at least not in New York. I'd get out of the city just as soon as the checks I'd ordered arrived. When I was upstate, I could start sending it around to the out-of-town literary magazines. Suwannee Review would be a good place to start, I reckoned, or maybe Iowa Review. I could explain to Reg later. Reg would understand. That seemed to solve the whole problem, so I took a drink to celebrate. And then the drink took a drink. And then the drink took the man, so to speak. I blacked out. I only had one more blackout left in me, as it happened. The next day, my Arvin Company checks came. I typed one of them up and went to see my friend, the co-drawer. There was another one of those tiresome cross-examinations, but this time I kept my temper. I wanted that signature. Finally, I got it. I went to a business supply store and had them make up an Arvin Company letter stamp while I waited. I stamped a return address on a business envelope, typed Reg's address, the confectioner's sugar was out of my machine, but the key still had a tendency to stick, and added a brief personal note, saying that no check to an author had ever given me more personal pleasure, and that was true, still is. It was almost an hour before I could bring myself to mail it. I just couldn't get over how official it looked. You never would have known that a smelly drunk who hadn't changed his underwear in about 10 days had put that one together. He paused, crushed out his cigarette, looked at his watch. Then, oddly, like a conductor announcing a train's arrival in some city of importance, he said, "We have reached the inexplicable. This is the point in my story which most interested the two psychiatrists and various mental caseworkers with whom I was associated over the next 30 months of my life. It was the only part of it they really wanted me to recant, as a sign that I was getting well again. As one of them put it, 'This is the only part of your story which cannot be explicated as faulty induction, once, that is, your sense of logic has been mended.' Finally, I did recant, because I knew, even if they didn't, that I was getting well, and I was damned anxious to get out of the sanitarium. I thought if I didn't get out fairly soon, I'd go crazy all over again. So I recanted. Galileo did, too, when they held his feet to the fire, but I have never recanted in my own mind. I don't say that what I'm about to tell you really happened. I only say I still believe it happened. That's a small qualification, but to me it's crucial. So, my friends, the inexplicable. I spent the next 2 days preparing to move upstate. The idea of driving the car didn't disturb me at all, by the way. I had read as a kid that the inside of a car is one of the safest places to be during an electrical storm because the rubber tires serve as near-perfect insulators. I was actually looking forward to getting in my old Chevrolet, cranking up all the windows and driving out of the city, which I had begun to see as a sink of lightning.
Nevertheless, part of my preparations included removing the bulb in the dome light, taping over the socket, and turning the headlight knob all the way to the left to kill the dash lights. When I came in, on the last night I meant to spend in the apartment, the place was empty, except for the kitchen table, the bed, and my typewriter in the den. The typewriter was sitting on the floor. I had no intention of taking it with me. It had too many bad associations. And besides, the keys were going to stick forever. Let the next tenant have it, I thought. It and Bellis, too. It was just sunset, and the place was a funny color. I was pretty drunk, and I had another bottle in my topcoat pocket against the watches of the night. I started across the den, meaning to go into the bedroom, I suppose. There I would sit on the bed and think about wires and electricity and free radiation and drink until I was drunk enough to go to sleep. What I called the den was really the living room. I made it my workplace because it had the nicest light in the whole apartment, a big westward-facing window that looked all the way to the horizon. That's something close to the miracle of the loaves and fishes in a fifth-floor Manhattan apartment, but the line of sight was there. I didn't question it, I just enjoyed it. That room was filled with a clear, lovely light, even on rainy days. But the quality of the light that evening was eerie. The sunset had filled the room with a red glow, furnace light. Empty, the room seemed too big. My heels made flat echoes on the hardwood floor. The typewriter sat in the middle of the floor, and I was just going around it when I saw there was a ragged scrap of paper stuck under the roller. That gave me a start, because I knew there had been no paper in the machine when I went out for the last time to get the fresh bottle. I looked around, wondering if there was someone, some intruder in the place with me. Except it wasn't really intruders or burglars or junkies I was thinking of. It was ghosts. I saw a ragged blank place on the wall to the left of the bedroom door. I at least understood where the paper in the typewriter had come from. Someone had simply torn off a ragged piece of the old wallpaper. I was still looking at this when I heard a single, small, clear noise. Clack. From behind me. I jumped and whirled around with my heart knocking in my throat. I was terrified, but I knew what that sound was just the same. There was no question at all. You work with words all your life and you know the sound of a typewriter platen hitting paper, even in a deserted room at dusk where there is no one to strike the key. They looked at him in the dark, their faces blurred, white circles, saying nothing, slightly huddled together now. The writer's wife was holding one of the writer's hands tightly in both of her own. I felt outside myself, unreal. Perhaps this is always the way one feels when one arrives at the point of the inexplicable. I walked slowly over to the typewriter. My heart was pounding madly up there in my throat, but I felt mentally calm. Icy, even. Clack! Another platen popped up. I saw it this time. The key was in the third row from the top on the left. I got down on my knees very slowly, and then all the muscles in my legs seemed to go slack, and I half swooned the rest of the way down until I was sitting there in front of the typewriter with my dirty London fog topcoat spread around me like the skirt of a girl who has made her very deepest curtsy. The typewriter clacked twice more, fast, paused, then clacked again. Each clack made the same kind of flat echo my footfalls had made on the floor. The wallpaper had been rolled into the machine so that the side with the dried glue on it was facing out. The letters were ripply and bumpy, but I could read them. R-A-C-K-N, it said. Then it clacked again, and the word was Rackney. Then, he cleared his throat and grinned a little. Even all these years later, this is hard to tell. To just say it right out. Okay. The simple fact, with no icing on it, is this. I saw a hand come out of the typewriter. An incredibly tiny hand. It came out from between the keys B and N in the bottom row, curled itself into a fist, and hammered down on the space bar. The machine jumped a space, very fast, like a hiccup, and the hand drew back down inside. The agent's wife giggled shrilly. "Can it, Marcia?" the agent said softly, and she did. "The clacks began to come a little faster," the editor went on. "And after a while I fancied I could hear the creature that was shoving the key arms up gasping, the way anyone will gasp when he is working hard, coming closer and closer to his physical limit. After a while the machine was hardly printing at all, and most of the keys were filled with that old gluey stuff, but I could read the impressions. It got out, 'Rachne is D,' and then the Y key stuck to the glue. I looked at it for a moment, and then I reached out one finger and freed it. I don't know if it... Bellis could have freed it himself. I think not. But I didn't want to see it... him try. Just the fist was enough to have me tottering on the brink if I saw the elf entire, so to speak. I think I really would have gone crazy. And there was no question of getting up to run. All the strength had gone out of my legs. Clack, 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 those tiny grunts and sobs of effort. And after every word, that pallid, ink and dirt-streaked fist would come out between the B and the N and hammer down on the space bar. I don't know exactly how long it went on, 7 minutes maybe, or 10, or maybe forever. Finally, the clack stopped, and I realized I couldn't hear him breathing anymore. Maybe he fainted, maybe he just gave up and went away, or maybe he died, had a heart attack or something. All I really know for sure is that the message was not finished. It read, completely in lower case, 'Rachne is dying. It's the little boy Jimmy. Thorpe doesn't know. Tell Thorpe Rachne is dying. The little boy Jimmy is killing Rachne Bell.' And that was all. I found the strength to get to my feet then, and I left the room. I walked in great big tippy-toe steps as if I thought I had gone to sleep, and if I made any of those flat, echoey noises on the bare wood, it would wake up and the typing would start again. And I thought if it did, the first clack would start me screaming, and then I would just go on until my heart or my head burst. My Chevy was in the parking lot down the street, all gassed and loaded and ready to go. I got in behind the wheel and remembered the bottle in my topcoat pocket. My hands were shaking so badly that I dropped it, but it landed on the seat and didn't break. I remembered the blackouts and my friends. Right then, a blackout was exactly what I wanted and exactly what I got. I remember taking the first drink from the neck of the bottle and the second. I remember turning the key over to accessory and getting Frank Sinatra on the radio singing that old black magic, which seemed fitting enough under the circumstances, so to speak. I remember singing along and having a few more drinks. I was in the back row of the lot, and I could see the traffic light on the corner going through its paces. I kept thinking of those flat, clacking sounds in the empty room and the fading red light in the den. I kept thinking of those puffing sounds as if some bodybuilding elf had hung fishing sinkers on the ends of a Q-tip and was doing bench presses inside my old typewriter. I kept seeing the pebbly surface on the backside of that torn scrap of wallpaper. My mind kept wanting to examine what must have gone on before I came back to the apartment. Kept wanting to see it. Him, Bellis, jumping up, grabbing the loose edge of the wallpaper by the door to the bedroom because it was the only thing left in the room approximating paper, hanging on, finally tearing it loose and carrying it back to the typewriter on his head, like the leaf of a nipa palm. I kept trying to imagine how it could ever have run it into the typewriter. And none of that was blacking out, so I kept drinking. And Frank Sinatra stopped, and there was an ad for Crazy Eddie's, and then Sarah Vaughan came on singing I'm Gonna Sit Right Down and Write Myself a Letter, and that was something else I could relate to since I'd just done that recently, or at least I thought I had, and up until tonight when something happened to give me cause to rethink my position on that matter, so to speak, and I sang along with good old Sarah's soul, and right about then I must have achieved escape velocity. because in the middle of the second chorus, with no lag at all, I was puking my guts out while somebody first thumped my back with his palms and then lifted my elbows behind me and put them down and then thumped my back with his palms again. That was the trucker. Every time he thumped, I'd feel a great clot of liquid rise up in my throat and get ready to go back down, except then he'd lift my elbows, and every time he lifted my elbows, I'd puke again, and most of it wasn't even black velvet, but river water. When I was able to lift my head enough to look around, it was 6 o'clock in the evening, 3 days later, and I was lying on the bank of the Jackson River in western Pennsylvania, about 60 miles north of Pittsburgh. My Chevy was sticking out of the river, rear end up. I could still read the McCarthy sticker on the bumper. "Is there another fresco, love? My throat's dry as hell." The writer's wife fetched him one silently, and when she handed it to him, she impulsively bent and kissed his wrinkled alligator-hide cheek. He smiled, and his eyes sparkled in the dim light. She was, however, a good and kindly woman, and the sparkle did not in any way fool her. It was never merriness which made eyes sparkle that way. "Thank you, Meg." He drank deeply, coughed, waved away the offer of a cigarette. "I've had enough of those for the evening, and we're to quit them entirely. In my next incarnation, so to speak." The rest of my own tale really needs no telling. It would have against it the only sin that any tale can ever really be guilty of. It's predictable. They fished something like 40 bottles of black velvet out of my car, a good many of them empty. I was babbling about elves and electricity and fornits and plutonium miners and faunus, and I seemed utterly insane to them, and that, of course, is exactly what I was. Now, here's what happened in Omaha while I was driving around, according to the gas credit slips in the Chevy's glove compartment, 5 northeastern states. All of this, you understand, was information I obtained from Jane Thorpe over a long and painful period of correspondence, which culminated in a face-to-face meeting in New Haven, where she now lives, shortly after I was dismissed from the sanitarium as a reward for finally recanting. At the end of that meeting, we wept in each other's arms, and that was when I began to believe that there could be a real life for me, perhaps even happiness again. That day, around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, there was a knock at the door of the Thorpe home. It was a telegraph boy. The telegram was from me, the last item of our unfortunate correspondence. It read, "Reg, have reliable information that Rackney is dying. It's the little boy according to Bellis. Bellis says the boy's name is Jimmy. Fornit Somme Fornus. Henry." In case that marvelous Howard Baker question of what did he know and when did he know it has gone through your mind, I can tell you that I knew Jane had hired a cleaning woman. I didn't know, except through Bellis, that she had a little devil son named Jimmy. I suppose you'll have to take my word for that, although in all fairness I have to add that the shrinks who worked on my case over the next 2.5 years never did. When the telegram came, Jane was at the grocery store. She found it after Reg was dead in one of his back pockets. The time of transmission and delivery were both noted on it, along with the added line, "No telephone, deliver original." Jane said that although the telegram was only a day old, it had been so much handled that it looked as if he'd had it for a month. In a way, that telegram, those 26 words, was the real flexible bullet. And I fired it directly into Reg Thorpe's brain all the way from Paterson, New Jersey, and I was so fucking drunk I don't even remember doing it. During the last 2 weeks of his life, Reg had fallen into a pattern that seemed normality itself. He got up at 6, made breakfast for himself and his wife, then wrote for an hour. Around 8 o'clock he would lock his study and take the dog for a long, leisurely walk around the neighborhood. He was very forthcoming on these walks, stopping to chat with anyone who wanted to chat with him, tying the pooch outside a nearby cafe to have a mid-morning cup of coffee, and then rambling on again. He rarely got back to the house before noon. On many days it was 12:30 or 1 o'clock. Part of this was an effort to escape the garrulous Gertrude Rulin, Jane believed, because his pattern hadn't really begun to solidify until a couple of days after she started working for them. He would eat a light lunch, lie down for an hour or so, then get up and write for 2 or 3 hours. In the evenings, he would sometimes go next door to visit with the young people, either with Jane or alone. Sometimes he and Jane took in a movie or just sat in the living room and read. They turned in early, read usually a while before Jane. She wrote there was very little sex, and what there was of it was unsuccessful for both of them. But sex isn't as important for most women, she said, and Reg was working full out again, and that was a reasonable substitute for him. I would say that under the circumstances, those last 2 weeks were the happiest in the last 5 years. I damn near cried when I read that. I didn't know anything about Jimmy, but Reg did. Reg knew everything, except for the most important fact that Jimmy had started coming to work with his mother. How furious he must have been when he got my telegram and began to realize. Here they were, after all. And apparently his own wife was one of them, because she was in the house when Gertrude and Jimmy were there, and she had never said a thing to Reg about Jimmy. What was it he had written to me in that earlier letter? Sometimes I wonder about my wife. When she arrived home on that day the telegram came, she found Reg gone. There was a note on the kitchen table which said, "Love, I've gone down to the bookstore, back by supper time." This seemed perfectly fine to Jane. But if Jane had known about my telegram, the very normality of that note would have scared the hell out of her, I think. She would have understood that Reg believed she had changed sides. Reg didn't go near any bookstore. He went to Little John's Gun Emporium downtown. He bought a .45 automatic and 2,000 rounds of ammunition. He would have bought an AK-70 if Little John's had been allowed to sell them. He meant to protect his Fornets, you see, from Jimmy, from Gertrude, from Jane, from them. Everything went according to established routine the next morning. She remembered thinking he was wearing an awfully heavy sweater for such a warm fall day, but that was all. The sweater, of course, was because of the gun. He went out to walk the dog with a .45 stuffed into the waistband of his chinos. Except the restaurant, where he usually got his morning coffee, was as far as he went, and he went directly there with no lingering or conversation along the way. He took the pup around to the loading area, tied its leash to a railing, and then went back toward his house by way of back yards. He knew the schedule of the young people next door very well, knew they would all be out. He knew where they kept their spare key. He let himself in, went upstairs, and watched his own house. At 8:40, he saw Gertrude Rulin arrive, and Gertrude wasn't alone. There was, indeed, a small boy with her. Jimmy Rulin's boisterous first-grade behavior convinced the teacher and the school guidance counselor almost at once that everyone, except maybe Jimmy's mother, who could have used a rest from Jimmy, would be better off if he waited another year. Jimmy was stuck with repeating kindergarten, and he had afternoon sessions for the first half of the year. The two daycare centers in her area were full, and she couldn't change to afternoons for the Thorpes because she had another cleaning job on the other side of town from 2 to 4. The upshot of everything was Jane's reluctant agreement that Gertrude could bring Jimmy with her until she was able to make other arrangements, or until Reg found out, as he was sure to do. She thought Reg might not mind. He had been so sweetly reasonable about everything lately. On the other hand, he might have a fit. If that happened, other arrangements would have to be made. Gertrude said she understood, and for heaven's sake, Jane added, the boy was not to touch any of Reg's things. Gertrude said for sure not. The mister's study door was locked and would stay locked. Thorpe must have crossed between the 2 yards like a sniper crossing no man's land. He saw Gertrude and Jane washing bed linen in the kitchen. He didn't see the boy. He moved along the side of the house. No one was in the dining room, no one in the bedroom. And then, in the study where Reg had morbidly expected to see him, there Jimmy was. The kid's face was hot with excitement, and Reg surely must have believed that here was a bona fide agent of they at last. The boy was holding some sort of death ray in his hand. It was pointed at the desk, and from inside his typewriter, Reg could hear Rackney screaming. You may think I'm attributing subjective data to a man who is now dead, or to be more blunt, making stuff up, but I'm not. In the kitchen, both Jane and Gertrude heard the distinctive warbling sound of Jimmy's plastic space blaster. He'd been shooting it around the house ever since he started coming with his mother, and Jane hoped daily that its batteries would go dead. There was no mistaking the sound. No mistaking the place it was coming from, either. Reg's study. The kid really was Dennis the Menace material, you know. If there was a room in the house where he wasn't supposed to go, that was the one place he had to go or die of curiosity. It didn't take him long to discover that Jane kept a key to Reg's study on the dining room mantel, either. Had he been in there before? I think so. Jane said she remembered giving the boy an orange 3 or 4 days before, and later when she was clearing out the house, she found orange peels under the little studio sofa in that room. Reg didn't eat oranges, claimed he was allergic to them. Jane dropped the sheet she was washing back into the sink and rushed into the bedroom. She heard the loud wah-wah-wah of the space blaster, and she heard Jimmy yelling, "I'll get you! You can't run! I can see you through the glass!" And she said that she heard something screaming. A high, despairing sound, she said, so full of pain it was almost insupportable. When I heard that, she said, I knew that I would have to leave Reg no matter what happened, because all the old wives' tales were true. Madness was catching, because it was Rackne I was hearing. Somehow that rotten little kid was shooting Rackne, killing it with a $2 space gun from Kresge's. The study door was standing open, the key in it. Later on that day, I saw one of the dining room chairs standing by the mantel with Jimmy's sneaker prints all over the seat. He was bent over Reg's typewriter table. Reg, had an old office model with glass inserts in the sides. Jimmy had the muzzle of his blaster pressed against one of those and was shooting it into the typewriter. Wah, 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 and purple pulses of light shooting out of the typewriter. And suddenly I could understand everything Reg had ever said about electricity, because although that thing ran on nothing more than harmless old C or D cells, it really did feel as if there were waves of poison coming out of that gun and rolling through my head and frying my brains. "I see her in there!" Jimmy was screaming, and his face was filled with a small boy's glee. It was both beautiful and somehow gruesome. "You can't run away from Captain Future! You're dead, alien!" And that screaming, getting weaker, smaller. "Jimmy, you stop it!" I yelled. He jumped. I'd startled him. He turned around, looked at me, stuck out his tongue, and then pushed the blaster against the glass panel and started shooting again. Wah, 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 on that rotten purple light. Gertrude was coming down the hall, yelling for him to stop, to get out of there, that he was going to get the whipping of his life. And then the front door burst open, and Reg came up the hall, bellowing. I got one good look at him and understood that he was insane. The gun was in his hand. "Don't you shoot my baby!" Gertrude screamed when she saw him and reached out to grapple with him. Reg simply clubbed her aside. Jimmy didn't even seem to realize any of this was going on. He just went on shooting the space blaster into the typewriter. I could see that purple light pulsing in the blackness between the keys, and it looked like one of those electrical arcs they tell you not to look at without a pair of special goggles, because otherwise it might boil your retinas and make you blind. Reg came in, shoving past me, knocking me over. "Rackne!" he screamed. "You're killing Rackne!" And even as Reg was rushing across the room, apparently planning to kill that child, Jane told me, I had time to wonder just how many times he had been in that room shooting that gun into the typewriter when his mother and I were maybe upstairs changing beds or in the backyard hanging clothes where we couldn't hear the wah-wah-wah, where we couldn't hear that thing, the fornit, inside screaming. Jimmy didn't stop even when Reg came bursting in. Just kept shooting into the typewriter as if he knew it was his last chance. And since then I have wondered if perhaps Reg wasn't right about they, too. Only maybe they just sort of float around, and every now and then they dive into a person's head like someone doing a double gainer into a swimming pool, and they get that somebody to do the dirty work and then check out again, and the guy they were in says, "Huh, me did what?" And in the second before Reg got there, the screaming from inside the typewriter turned into a brief, drilling shriek, and I saw blood spatter all over the inside of that glass insert, as if whatever was in there had finally just exploded, the way they say a live animal will explode if you put it in a microwave oven. I know how crazy it sounds, but I saw that blood. It hit the glass in a blot and then started to run. "Got it," Jimmy said, highly satisfied. "Got..." Then Reg threw him all the way across the room. He hit the wall. The gun was jarred out of his hand, hit the floor and broke. It was nothing but plastic and ever-ready batteries, of course. Reg looked into the typewriter and he screamed. Not a scream of pain or fury, although there was fury in it. Mostly it was a scream of grief. He turned toward the boy then. Jimmy had fallen to the floor, and whatever he had been, if he ever was anything more than just a mischievous little boy, now he was just a six-year-old in terror. Reg pointed the gun at him, and that's all I remember.
The editor finished his soda and put the can carefully aside.
Gertrude Rulin and Jimmy Rulin remember enough to make up for the lack, he said. Jane called out, Reg, no! And when he looked around at her, she got to her feet and grappled with him. He shot her, shattering her left elbow, but she didn't let go. As she continued to grapple with him, Gertrude called to her son, and Jimmy ran to her. Reg pushed Jane away and shot her again. This bullet tore along the left side of her skull, even an eighth of an inch to the right, and he would have killed her. There is little doubt of that, and none at all that if not for Jane Thorpe's intervention, he would have surely killed Jimmy Rulin and quite possibly the boy's mother as well. He did shoot the boy as Jimmy ran into his mother's arms just outside the door. The bullet entered Jimmy's left buttock on a downward course. It exited from his upper left thigh, missing the bone, and passed through Gertrude Rulin's shin. There was a lot of blood, but no major damage done to either. Gertrude slammed the study door and carried her screaming, bleeding son down the hallway and out the front door.
The editor paused again, thoughtfully.
Jane was either unconscious by that time or she has deliberately chosen to forget what happened next. Reg sat down in his office chair and put the muzzle of the .45 against the center of his forehead. He pulled the trigger. The bullet did not pass through his brain and leave him a living vegetable, nor did it travel in a semicircle around his skull and exit harmlessly on the far side. The fantasy was flexible, but the final bullet was as hard as it could be. He fell forward across the typewriter, dead. When the police broke in, they found him that way. Jane was sitting in a far corner, semi-conscious. The typewriter was covered with blood, presumably filled with blood as well. Head wounds are very, very messy. All of the blood was type O, Reg Thorpe's type. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is my story. I can tell no more.
Indeed, the editor's voice had been reduced to little more than a husky whisper. There was none of the usual post-party chatter, or even the awkwardly bright conversation people sometimes use to cover a cocktail party indiscretion of some moment, or to at least disguise the fact that things had at some point become much more serious than a dinner party situation usually warranted. But as the writer saw the editor to his car, he was unable to forbear one final question. The story, he said. What happened to the story?
You mean Reg's...
The Ballad of the Flexible Bullet, that's right. The story that caused it all. That was the real flexible bullet, for you if not for him. What in the hell happened to this story that was so goddamn great?
The editor opened the door of his car. It was a small blue Chevette with a sticker on the back bumper which read, Friends don't let friends drive drunk.
No, it was never published. If Reg had a carbon copy, he destroyed it following my receipt and acceptance of the tale. Considering his paranoid feelings about they, that would have been very much in character. I had his original, plus three photocopies with me when I went into the Jackson River. All four in a cardboard carton. If I'd put that carton in the trunk, I would have the story now, because the rear end of my car never went under. Even if it had, the pages could have been dried out. But I wanted it close to me, so I put it in the front, on the driver's side. The windows were open when I went into the water. The pages, I assume they just floated away and were carried out to sea. I'd rather believe that than believe they rotted along with the rest of the trash at the bottom of that river, or were eaten by catfish or something even less aesthetically pleasing. To believe they were carried out to sea is more romantic and slightly more unlikely, but in matters of what I choose to believe, I find I can still be flexible, so to speak.
The editor got into his small car and drove away. The writer stood and watched until the taillights had winked out, and then turned around. Meg was there, standing at the head of their walk in the darkness, smiling a little tentatively at him. Her arms were crossed tightly across her bosom, although the night was warm. "We're the last two," she said. "Want to go in?" "Sure." Halfway up the walk she stopped and said, "There are no Fornits in your typewriter, are there, Paul?" And the writer, who had sometimes, often, wondered exactly where the words did come from, said bravely, "Absolutely not." They went inside, arm in arm, and closed the door against the night.
The Reach.
"The Reach was wider in those days," Stella Flanders told her great-grandchildren in the last summer of her life, the summer before she began to see ghosts. The children looked at her with wide, silent eyes, and her son, Alden, turned from his seat on the porch where he was whittling. It was Sunday, and Alden wouldn't take his boat out on Sundays, no matter how high the price of lobster was. "What do you mean, Graham?" Tommy asked, but the old woman did not answer. She only sat in her rocker by the cold stove, her slippers bumping placidly on the floor. Tommy asked his mother, "What does she mean?" Lois only shook her head, smiled, and sent them out with pots to pick berries. Stella thought she's forgot. Or did she ever know? The Reach had been wider in those days. If anyone knew it was so, that person was Stella Flanders. She had been born in 1884, she was the oldest resident of Goat Island, and she had never once in her life been to the mainland. "Do you love?" This question had begun to plague her, and she did not even know what it meant. Fall set in. A cold fall, without the necessary rain to bring a really fine color to the trees, either on Goat or on Raccoon Head across the reach. The wind blew long, cold notes that fall, and Stella felt each note resonate in her heart. On November 19, when the first flurries came swirling down out of a sky the color of white chrome, Stella celebrated her birthday. Most of the village turned out. Hattie Stoddard came, whose mother had died of pleurisy in 1954, and whose father had been lost with the dancer in 1941. Richard and Mary Dodge came, Richard moving slowly up the path on his cane, his arthritis riding him like an invisible passenger. Sarah Havelock came, of course. Sarah's mother, Annabelle, had been Stella's best friend. They had gone to the island school together, grades 1 to 8, and Annabelle had married Tommy Frayn, who had pulled her hair in the 5th grade and made her cry, just as Stella had married Bill Flanders, who had once knocked all of her schoolbooks out of her arms and into the mud, but she had managed not to cry. Now both Annabelle and Tommy were gone, and Sarah was the only one of their 7 children still on the island. Her husband, George Havelock, who had been known to everyone as Big George, had died a nasty death over on the mainland in 1967, the year there was no fishing. An axe had slipped in Big George's hand. There had been blood, too much of it, and an island funeral 3 days later. And when Sarah came in to Stella's party and cried, "Happy birthday, Graham," Stella hugged her tight and closed her eyes. Do you love? But she did not cry. There was a tremendous birthday cake. Hattie had made it with her best friend, Vera Spruce. The assembled company bellowed out "Happy birthday to you" in a combined voice that was loud enough to drown out the wind, for a little while, anyway. Even Alden sang, who in the normal course of events would sing only "Onward, Christian Soldiers" and the doxology in church, and would mouth the words of all the rest with his head hunched and his big old jug ears just as red as tomatoes. There were 95 candles on Stella's cake, and even over the singing she heard the wind, although her hearing was not what it had once been. She thought the wind was calling her name. "I was not the only one," she would have told Lois's children if she could. "In my day there were many that lived and died on the island. There was no mail boat in those days. Bull Symes used to bring the mail when there was mail. There was no ferry either. If you had business on the head, your man took you in the lobster boat. So far as I know, there wasn't a flushing toilet on the island till 1946. 'Twas Bull's boy, Harold, that put in the first one, the year after the heart attack carried Bull off while he was out dragging traps. I remember seeing them bring Bull home. I remember that they brought him up wrapped in a tarpaulin, and how one of his green boots poked out. I remember... And they would say, "What, Graham? What do you remember?" How would she answer them? Was there more? On the first day of winter, a month or so after the birthday party, Stella opened the back door to get stove wood and discovered a dead sparrow on the back stoop. She bent down carefully, picked it up by one foot, and looked at it. "Frozen," she announced. And something inside her spoke another word. It had been 40 years since she had seen a frozen bird, 1938, the year the Reach had frozen. Shuddering, pulling her coat closer, she threw the dead sparrow in the old rusty incinerator as she went by it. The day was cold. The sky was a clear, deep blue. On the night of her birthday, 4 inches of snow had fallen, had melted, and no more had come since then. "Gotta come soon," Larry McKean down at the Goat Island store said sagely, as if daring winter to stay away. Stella got to the woodpile, picked herself an armload, and carried it back to the house. Her shadow, crisp and clean, followed her. As she reached the back door, where the sparrow had fallen, Bill spoke to her. But the cancer had taken Bill 12 years before. "Stella," Bill said. And she saw his shadow fall beside her, longer but just as clear-cut. The shadow bill of his shadow cap twisted jauntily off to one side, just as he had always worn it. Stella felt a scream lodged in her throat. It was too large to touch her lips. "Stella," he said again, "when are you coming across to the mainland? We'll get Norm Jolly's old Ford and go down to Beans in Freeport just for a lark. What do you say?" She wheeled, almost dropping her wood. And there was no one there, just the dooryard sloping down to the hill, then the wild white grass, and beyond all, at the edge of everything, clear-cut and somehow magnified, the Reach and the mainland beyond it. "Graham, what's the Reach?" Lona might have asked, although she never had. And she would have given them the answer any fisherman knew by rote. A reach is a body of water between two bodies of land, a body of water which is open at either end. The old lobsterman's joke went like this: "Know how to read your compass when the fog comes, boys. Between Jonesport and London there's a mighty long reach." "Reach is the water between the island and the mainland," she might have amplified, giving them molasses cookies and hot tea laced with sugar. "I know that much. I know it as well as my husband's name, and how he used to wear his hat." "Graham," Lona would say, "how come you never been across the reach?" "Honey," she would say, "I never saw any reason to go." In January, 2 months after the birthday party, the reach froze for the first time since 1938. The radio warned islanders and mainlanders alike not to trust the ice, but Stewie McClelland and Russell Bowie took Stewie's bombardier skidoo out anyway after a long afternoon spent drinking apple wine. And sure enough, the skidoo went into the reach. Stewie managed to crawl out, although he lost 1 foot to frostbite. The reach took Russell Bowie and carried him away. That January 25, there was a memorial service for Russell. Stella went on her son Alden's arm, and he mouthed the words to the hymns and boomed out the doxology in his great, tuneless voice before the benediction. Stella sat afterward with Sarah Havelock and Hattie Stoddard and Vera Spruce in the glow of the wood fire in the town hall basement. A going-away party for Russell was being held, complete with Zayrex punch and nice little cream cheese sandwiches cut into triangles. The men, of course, kept wandering out back for a nip of something a bit stronger than Zayrex. Russell Bowie's new widow sat red-eyed and stunned beside Ewell McCracken, the minister. She was 7 months big with child. It would be her fifth. And Stella, half-dozing in the heat of the wood stove, thought, "She'll be crossing the reach soon enough, I guess.
She'll move to Freeport or Lewiston and go for a waitress, I guess.
She looked around at Vera and Hattie to see what the discussion was.
No, I didn't hear, Hattie said. What did Freddie say?
They were talking about Freddie Dinsmore, the oldest man on the island, 2 years younger than me, though, Stella thought with some satisfaction, who had sold out his store to Larry McKean in 1960 and now lived on his retirement.
Said he'd never seen such a winter, Vera said, taking out her knitting. He says it is going to make people sick.
Sarah Havelock looked at Stella and asked if Stella had ever seen such a winter. There had been no snow since that first little bit. The ground lay crisp and bare and brown. The day before, Stella had walked 30 paces into the back field, holding her right hand level at the height of her thigh, and the grass there had snapped in a neat row with a sound like breaking glass.
No, Stella said. The reach froze in 38, but there was snow that year. You remember Bull Symes, Hattie?
Hattie laughed.
I think I still have the black and blue he gave me on my sit-upon at the New Year's party in 53. He pinched me that hard. What about him?
Bull and my own man walked across to the mainland that year, Stella said, that February of 1938. Strapped on snowshoes, walked across to Dorrit's Tavern on the Head, had him eat a shot of whiskey and walked back. They asked me to come along. They were like two little boys off to the sliding with a toboggan between them.
They were looking at her, touched by the wonder of it. Even Vera was looking at her wide-eyed, and Vera had surely heard the tale before. If you believe the stories, Bull and Vera had once played some house together, although it was hard looking at Vera now to believe that she had ever been so young.
"And you didn't go?" Sarah asked, perhaps seeing the reach of the reach in her mind's eye.
So white it was almost blue in the heatless winter sunshine, the sparkle of the snow crystals, the mainland drawing closer, walking across, yes, walking across the ocean just like Jesus out of the boat, leaving the island for the one and only time in your life on foot.
No,
Stella said. Suddenly she wished she had brought her own knitting.
I didn't go with him.
Why not?
Hattie asked almost indignantly.
It was wash day,
Stella almost snapped. And then Missy Bowie Russell's widow broke into loud, braying sobs. Stella looked over, and there sat Bill Flanders in his red and black checked jacket, hat cocked to one side, smoking a Herbert Tarratton with another tucked behind his ear for later. She felt her heart leap into her chest and choke between beats. She made a noise, but just then a knot popped like a rifle shot in the stove, and neither of the other ladies heard.
Poor thing, Sarah nearly cooed.
Well, shut up, that good-for-nothing, Hattie grunted.
She searched for the grim depth of the truth concerning the departed Russell Bowie and found it.
Little more than a tramp for pay, that man. She's well out of that two-horse trace.
Stella barely heard these things. There sat Bill, close enough to the Reverend McCracken to have tweaked his nose if he so had a mind. He looked no more than 40. His eyes barely marked by the crow's feet that had later sunk so deep, wearing his flannel pants and his gum-rubber boots with the grey wool socks folded neatly down over the tops.
"We're waiting on you, Stell," he said. "You come on across and see the mainland. You won't need no snowshoes this year."
There he sat, in the town hall basement, big as Billy be damned. And then another knot exploded in the stove and he was gone. And the Reverend McCracken went on comforting Missy Bowie as if nothing had happened. That night Vera called up Annie Phillips on the phone, and in the course of the conversation mentioned to Annie that Stella Flanders didn't look well, not at all well.
"Alden would have a scratch of a job getting her off island if she took sick," Annie said.
Annie liked Alden because her own son, Toby, had told her Alden would take nothing stronger than beer. Annie was strictly temperance herself.
"Wouldn't get her off at all unless she was in a comer," Vera said, pronouncing the word in the Down East fashion. "When Stella says frog, Alden jumps. Alden ain't but half bright, you know. Stella pretty much runs him."
"Oh, yeah," Annie said. Just then there was a metallic crackling sound on the line. Vera could hear Annie Phillips for a moment longer, not the words, just the sound of her voice going on behind the crackling, and then there was nothing. The wind had gusted up high and the phone lines had gone down, maybe into Godlin's Pond or maybe down by Borrow's Cove, where they went into the reach, sheathed in rubber. It was possible that they had gone down on the other side, on the head. And some might even have said, only half-joking, that Russell Bowie had reached up a cold hand to snap the cable just for the hell of it. Not 700 feet away, Stella Flanders lay under her puzzle quilt and listened to the dubious music of Alden's snores in the other room. She listened to Alden so she wouldn't have to listen to the wind, but she heard the wind anyway, oh yes, coming across the frozen expanse of the reach, a mile and a half of water that was now overplated with ice, ice with lobsters down below and groupers, and perhaps the twisting, dancing body of Russell Bowie, who used to come each April with his old Rogers rototiller and turn her garden. Who'll turn the earth this April? She wondered as she lay cold and curled under her puzzle quilt. And as a dream in a dream, her voice answered her voice. Do you love? The wind gusted, rattling the storm window. It seemed that the storm window was talking to her, but she turned her face away from its words and did not cry. But Gran, Lona would press. She never gave up, not that one. She was like her mom and her grandmother before her. You still haven't told us why you never went across. Why, child, I have always had everything I wanted right here on Goat. But it's so small. We live in Portland. There's buses, Graham. I see enough of what goes on in cities on the TV. I guess I'll stay where I am. Hal was younger, but somehow more intuitive. He would not press her, as his sister might, but his question would go closer to the heart of things. You never wanted to go across, Graham? Never? And she would lean toward him and take his small hands and tell him how her mother and father had come to the island shortly after they were married, and how Bull Symes's grandfather had taken Stella's father as apprentice on his boat. She would tell him how her mother had conceived 4 times, but one of her babies had miscarried, and another had died a week after birth. She would have left the island if they could have saved it at the mainland hospital, but of course it was over before that was even thought of. She would tell them that Bill had delivered Jane, their grandmother, but not that when it was over he had gone into the bathroom and first puked and then wept like a hysterical woman who had her monthlies particularly bad. Jane, of course, had left the island at 14 to go to high school. Girls didn't get married at 14 anymore. And when Stella saw her go off on the boat with Bradley Maxwell, whose job it had been to ferry the kids back and forth that month, she knew in her heart that Jane was gone for good. Although she would come back for a while. She would tell them that Alden had come along 10 years later after they had given up, and as if to make up for his tardiness, here was Alden still, a lifelong bachelor. And in some ways Stella was grateful for that, because Alden was not terribly bright, and there were plenty of women willing to take advantage of a man with a slow brain and a good heart, although she would not tell the children that last either. She would say Lewis and Margaret Godlin begat Stella Godlin, who became Stella Flanders. Bill and Stella Flanders begat Jane and Alden Flanders, and Jane Flanders became Jane Wakefield. Richard and Jane Wakefield begat Lois Wakefield, who became Lois Perrot. David and Lois Perrot begat Lona and Hal. Those are your names, children. You are Godlin Flanders Wakefield Perrot. Your blood is in the stones of this island. And I stay here because the mainland is too far to reach. Yes, I love. I have loved, anyway, or at least tried to love. But memory is so wide and so deep, and I cannot cross. Godlin, Flanders, Wakefield, Perrow. That was the coldest February since the National Weather Service began keeping records. And by the middle of the month, the ice covering the reach was safe. Snowmobile buzzed and whined and sometimes turned over when they climbed the ice heaves wrong. Children tried to skate, found the ice too bumpy to be any fun, and went back to Godlin's pond on the far side of the hill. But not before little Justin McCracken, the minister's son, caught his skate in a fissure and broke his ankle. They took him over to the hospital on the mainland, where a doctor who owned a Corvette told him, "Son, it's going to be as good as new." Freddie Dinsmore died very suddenly, just 3 days after Justin McCracken broke his ankle. He caught the flu late in January, would not have the doctor, told everyone it was just a cold from going out to get the mail without my scarf, took to his bed, and died before anyone could take him across to the mainland and hook him up to all those machines they have waiting for guys like Freddie.
His son, George, a tosspot of the first water, even at the advanced age, for tosspots anyway, of 68, found Freddy, with a copy of the Bangor Daily News in one hand and his Remington unloaded near the other. Apparently he had been thinking of cleaning it just before he died. George Dinsmore went on a 3-week toot, said toot financed by someone who knew that George would have his old dad's insurance money coming. Hattie Stoddard went around telling anyone who would listen that old George Dinsmore was a sin and a disgrace, no better than a tramp for pay. There was a lot of flu around. The school closed for 2 weeks that February instead of the usual one, because so many pupils were out sick. "No snow breeds germs," Sarah Havelock said. Near the end of the month, just as people were beginning to look forward to the false comfort of March, Alden Flanders caught the flu himself. He walked around with it for nearly a week and then took to his bed with a fever of 101. Like Freddy, he refused to have the doctor, and Stella stewed and fretted and worried. Alden was not as old as Freddy, but that May he would turn 60. The snow came at last. 6 inches on Valentine's Day, another 6 on the 20th, and a foot in a good old norther on the leap, February 29. The snow lay white and strange between the cove and the mainland, like a sheep's meadow where there had been only gray and surging water at this time of year since time out of mind. Several people walked across to the mainland and back. No snowshoes were necessary this year because the snow had frozen to a firm, glittery crust. They might take a knock of whiskey, too, Stella thought, but they would not take it at Dorrit's. Dorrit's had burned down in 1958. And she saw Bill all 4 times. Once he told her, "Yacht come soon, Stella. We'll go steppin'. What do you say?" She could say nothing. Her fist was crammed deep into her mouth. "Everything I ever wanted or needed was here," she would tell them. "We had the radio, and now we have the television. And that's all I want of the world beyond the reach. I had my garden year in and year out, and lobster, why, we always used to have a pot of lobster stew on the back of the stove, and we used to take it off and put it behind the door in the pantry when the minister came calling, so he wouldn't see we were eating poor man's soup. I have seen good weather and bad, and if there were times when I wondered what it might be like to actually be in the Sears store instead of ordering from the catalog, or go into one of those Shaw's markets I see on TV instead of buying at the store here, or sending Alden across for something special like a Christmas capon or an Easter ham, or if I ever wanted just once to stand on Congress Street in Portland and watch all the people in their cars and on the sidewalks, more people in a single look than there are on the whole island these days. If I ever wanted those things, then I wanted this more. I am not strange, I am not peculiar, or even very eccentric for a woman of my years. My mother sometimes used to say, 'All the difference in the world is between work and want.' And I believe that to my very soul. I believe it is better to plow deep than wide. This is my place, and I love it." One day in middle March, with the sky as white and lowering as a loss of memory, Stella Flanders sat in her kitchen for the last time, laced up her boots over her skinny calves for the last time, and wrapped her bright red woolen scarf, a Christmas present from Hattie 3 Christmases past, around her neck for the last time. She wore a suit of Alden's long underwear under her dress. The waist of the drawers came up to just below the limp vestiges of her breasts, the shirt almost down to her knees. Outside, the wind was picking up again, and the radio said there would be snow by afternoon. She put on her coat and her gloves. After a moment of debate, she put a pair of Alden's gloves on over her own. Alden had recovered from the flu, and this morning he and Harley Blood were over rehanging a storm door for Mrs. Bowie, who had had a girl. Stella had seen it, and the unfortunate little mite looked just like her father. She stood at the window for a moment, looking out at the reach, and Bill was there, as she had suspected he might be, standing about halfway between the island and the head, standing on the reach just like Jesus out of the boat,
beckoning to her, seeming to tell her by gesture that the time was late if she ever intended to step a foot on the mainland in this life. "If it's what you want, Bill," she fretted in the silence, "God knows I don't." But the wind spoke other words. She did want to. She wanted to have this adventure. It had been a painful winter for her. The arthritis which came and went irregularly was back with a vengeance, flaring the joints of her fingers and knees with red fire and blue ice. One of her eyes had gotten dim and blurry, and just the other day Sarah had mentioned with some unease that the fire spot that had been there since Stella was 60 or so seemed to be growing by leaps and bounds. Worst of all, the deep, griping pain in her stomach had returned. And 2 mornings before, she had gotten up at 5 o'clock, worked her way along the exquisitely cold floor into the bathroom, and had spat a great wad of bright red blood into the toilet bowl. This morning there had been some more of it, foul-tasting stuff, coppery and shuddersome. The stomach pain had come and gone over the last 5 years, sometimes better, sometimes worse, and she had known almost from the beginning that it must be cancer. It had taken her mother and father, and her mother's father as well. None of them had lived past 70, and so she supposed she had beat the tables those insurance fellows kept by a carpenter's yard. "You eat like a horse," Alden told her, grinning, not long after the pains had begun and she had first observed the blood in her morning stool. "Don't you know that old fogies like you are supposed to be peckish?" "Get on or I'll swat you," Stella had answered, raising a hand to her grey-haired son, who ducked, mock-cringed, and cried, "Don't, Ma! I take it back!" Yes, she had eaten hearty. Not because she wanted to, but because she believed, as many of her generation did, that if you fed the cancer, it would leave you alone. And perhaps it worked, at least for a while. The blood in her stools came and went, and there were long periods when it wasn't there at all. Alden got used to her taking second helpings, and thirds when the pain was particularly bad. But she never gained a pound. Now it seemed the cancer had finally gotten around to what the froggies called the pièce de résistance. She started out the door and saw Alden's hat, the one with the fur-lined ear flaps, hanging on one of the pegs in the entry. She put it on. The bill came all the way down to her shaggy salt-and-pepper eyebrows, and then looked around one last time to see if she had forgotten anything. The stove was low, and Alden had left the drawer open too much again. She told him and told him, but that was one thing he was just never going to get straight. "Alden, you'll burn an extra quarter winter when I'm gone," she muttered, and opened the stove. She looked in a tight, dismayed gasp escaped her. She slammed the door shut and adjusted the drawer with trembling fingers. For a moment, just a moment, she had seen her old friend, Annabel Frayne, in the coals. It was her face to the life, even down to the mole on her cheek. And had Annabel winked at her? She thought of leaving Alden a note to explain where she had gone. But she thought perhaps Alden would understand, in his own slow way. Still writing notes in her head, "Since the first day of winter I have been seeing your father, and he says dying isn't so bad. At least I think that's it." Stella stepped out into the white day. The wind shook her, and she had to reset Alden's cap on her head before the wind could steal it for a joke and cartwheel it away. The cold seemed to find every chink in her clothing and twist into her. Damp, March cold, with wet snow on its mind. She set off down the hill toward the cove, being careful to walk on the cinders and clinkers that George Dinsmore had spread. Once George had gotten a job driving plow for the town of Raccoon Head, but during the big blow of 77 he had gotten smashed on rye whiskey and had driven the plow smack through not one, not two, but 3 power poles. There had been no lights overhead for 5 days. Stella remembered now how strange it had been, looking across the reach and seeing only blackness. A body got used to seeing that brave little nestle of lights. Now George worked on the island, and since there was no plow, he didn't get into much hurt. As she passed Russell Bowie's house, she saw Missy, pale as milk, looking out at her. Stella waved. Missy waved back. She would tell them this.
On the island, we always watched out for our own. When Gerd Henried broke the blood vessel in his chest that time, we had covered dish suppers one whole summer to pay for his operation in Boston. And Gerd came back alive, thank God. When George Dinsmore ran down those power poles and the hydro slapped a lien on his home, it was seen, too, that the hydro had their money, and George had enough of a job to keep him in cigarettes and booze. Why not? He was good for nothing else when his work day was done, although when he was on the clock, he would work like a dray horse. That one time he got into trouble was because it was at night, and night was always George's drinking time. His father kept him fed, at least. Now Missy Bowie is alone with another baby. Maybe she'll stay here and take her welfare and ADC money here. And most likely it won't be enough, but she'll get the help she needs. Probably she'll go, but if she stays, she'll not starve. And listen, Lona and Hal, if she stays, she may be able to keep something of this small world with the little reach on one side and the big reach on the other. Something it would be too easy to lose, hustling hash in Lewiston or donuts in Portland or drinks at the Nashville North in Bangor. And I am old enough not to beat around the bush about what that something might be. A way of being, and a way of living, a feeling. They had watched out for their own in other ways as well, but she would not tell them that. The children would not understand, nor would Lois and David, although Jane had known the truth. There was Norman and Eddie Wilson's baby that was born a mongoloid, its poor, dear little feet turned in, its bald skull lumpy and crated, its fingers webbed together as if it had dreamed too long and too deep while swimming that interior reach. Reverend McCracken had come and baptized the baby, and a day later Mary Dodge came, who even at that time had midwifed over 100 babies. And Norman took Eddie down the hill to see Frank Child's new boat, and although she could barely walk, Eddie went, with no complaint, although she had stopped in the door to look back at Mary Dodge, who was sitting calmly by the idiot baby's crib and knitting. Mary had looked up at her, and when their eyes met, Eddie burst into tears. "Come on," Norman had said, upset. "Come on, Eddie, come on." And when they came back an hour later, the baby was dead. One of those crib deaths. Wasn't it merciful he didn't suffer? And many years before that, before the war, during the Depression, three little girls had been molested, coming home from school, not badly molested, at least not where you could see the scar of the hurt. And they all told about a man who offered to show them a deck of cards he had with a different kind of dog on each one. He would show them this wonderful deck of cards, the man said, if the little girls would come into the bushes with him. And once in the bushes, this man said, "But you have to touch this first." One of the little girls was Gert Symes, who would go on to be voted Maine's Teacher of the Year in 1978 for her work at Brunswick High. And Gert, then only 5 years old, told her father that the man had some fingers gone on one hand. One of the other little girls agreed that this was so. The third remembered nothing. Stella remembered Alden going out one thundery day that summer without telling her where he was going, although she asked. Watching from the window, she had seen Alden meet Bull Symes at the bottom of the path, and then Freddie Dinsmore had joined them, and down at the cove she saw her own husband, whom she had sent out that morning, just as usual, with his dinner pail under his arm. More men joined them, and when they finally moved off, she counted just one under a dozen. The Reverend McCracken's predecessor had been among them, and that evening a fellow named Daniels was found at the foot of Slider's Point, where the rocks poke out of the surf like the fangs of a dragon that drowned with its mouth open. This Daniels was a fellow Big George Havelock had hired to help him put new seals under his house and a new engine in his Model A truck. From New Hampshire he was, and he was a sweet talker who had found other odd jobs to do when the work at the Havelocks was done, and in church he could carry a tune. Apparently, they said Daniels had been walking up on top of Slider's Point and had slipped, tumbling all the way to the bottom. His neck was broken and his head was bashed in. As he had no people that anyone knew of, he was buried on the island, and the Reverend McCracken's predecessor gave the graveyard eulogy, saying as how this Daniels had been a hard worker and a good help, even though he was two fingers shy on his right hand. Then he read the benediction, and the graveside group had gone back to the town hall basement, where they drank Xarex punch and ate cream cheese sandwiches. And Stella never asked her men where they had gone on the day Daniels fell from the top of Sliders Point. "Children," she would tell them, "we always watched out for our own. We had to, for the reach was wider in those days. And when the wind roared and the surf pounded and the dark came early, why, we felt very small, no more than dust motes in the mind of God. So it was natural for us to join hands, one with the other. We joined hands, children, and if there were times when we wondered what it was all for, or if there was ere such a thing as love at all, it was only because we had heard the wind and the waters on long winter nights, and we were afraid. No, I've never felt I needed to leave the island. My life was here. The reach was wider in those days." Stella reached the cove. She looked right and left, the wind blowing her dress out behind her like a flag. If anyone had been there, she would have walked further down and taken her chance on the tumbled rocks, although they were glazed with ice. But no one was there, and she walked out along the pier, past the old Symes boathouse. She reached the end and stood there for a moment, head held up, the wind blowing past the padded flaps of Alden's hat in a muffled flood. Bill was out there, beckoning. Beyond him, beyond the reach, she could see the Congo church over there on the head, its spire almost invisible against the white sky. Grunting, she sat down on the end of the pier, and then stepped onto the snow crust below. Her boots sank a little, not much. She set Alden's cap again, how the wind wanted to tear it off, and began to walk toward Bill. She thought once that she would look back, but she did not. She didn't believe her heart could stand that. She walked, her boots crunching into the crust, and listened to the faint thud and give of the ice. There was Bill, further back now, but still beckoning. She coughed, spat blood onto the white snow that covered the ice. Now the reach spread wide on either side, and she could, for the first time in her life, read the Stanton's Bait and Boat sign over there without Alden's binoculars. She could see the cars passing to and fro on the head's main street, and thought with real wonder, they can go as far as they want. Portland, Boston, New York City, imagine! And she could almost do it. Could almost imagine a road that simply rolled on and on, the boundaries of the world knocked wide. A snowflake skirled past her eyes. Another, a third. Soon it was snowing lightly, and she walked through a pleasant world of shifting bright white. She saw a raccoon head through a gauzy curtain that sometimes almost cleared. She reached up to set Alden's cap again, and snow puffed off the bill into her eyes. The wind twisted fresh snow up in filmy shapes, and in one of them she saw Carl Abersham, who had gone down with Hattie Stoddard's husband on the dancer. Soon, however, the brightness began to dull as the snow came harder. The head's main street dimmed, dimmed, and at last was gone. For a time longer she could make out the cross atop the church, and then that faded out too, like a false dream. Last to go was that bright yellow and black sign reading Stanton's Bait and Boat, where you could also get engine oil, flypaper, Italian sandwiches, and Budweiser to go. Then Stella walked in a world that was totally without color, a gray-white dream of snow. Just like Jesus out of the boat, she thought. And at last she looked back. But now the island was gone, too. She could see her tracks going back, losing definition, until only the faint half-circles of her heels could be seen,
and then nothing. Nothing at all. She thought, it's a whiteout. You got to be careful, Stella, or you'll never get to the mainland. You'll just walk around in a big circle until you're worn out, and then you'll freeze to death out here. She remembered Bill telling her once that when you were lost in the woods, you had to pretend that the leg which was on the same side of your body as your smart hand was lame. Otherwise, that smart leg would begin to lead you, and you'd walk in a circle and not even realize it, until you came around to your back trail again. Stella didn't believe she could afford to have that happen to her. Snow today, tonight, and tomorrow, the radio had said, and in a whiteout such as this, she would not even know if she came around to her back trail, for the wind and the fresh snow would erase it long before she could return to it. Her hands were leaving her, in spite of the two pairs of gloves she wore, and her feet had been gone for some time. In a way, this was almost a relief. The numbness at least shut the mouth of her clamoring arthritis. Stella began to limp now, making her left leg work harder. The arthritis in her knees had not gone to sleep, and soon they were screaming at her. Her white hair flew out behind her. Her lips had drawn back from her teeth. She still had her own, all save four. And she looked straight ahead, waiting for that yellow and black sign to materialize out of the flying whiteness. It did not happen. Sometime later she noticed that the day's bright whiteness had begun to dull to a more uniform gray. The snow fell heavier and thicker than ever. Her feet were still planted on the crust, but now she was walking through 5 inches of fresh snow. She looked at her watch, but it had stopped. Stella realized she must have forgotten to wind it that morning for the first time in 20 or 30 years. Or had it just stopped for good? It had been her mother's, and she had sent it with Alden twice to the head, where Mr. Dosti had first marveled over it and then cleaned it. Her watch, at least, had been to the mainland. She fell down for the first time some 15 minutes after she began to notice the day's growing grayness. For a moment she remained on her hands and knees, thinking it would be so easy just to stay here, to curl up and listen to the wind. And then the determination that had brought her through so much reasserted itself, and she got up, grimacing. She stood in the wind, looking straight ahead, willing her eyes to see. But they saw nothing. Be dark soon. Well, she had gone wrong. She had slipped off to one side or the other. Otherwise she would have reached the mainland by now. Yet she didn't believe she had gone so far wrong that she was walking parallel to the mainland, or even back in the direction of Goat. An interior navigator in her head whispered that she had overcompensated and slipped off to the left. She believed that she was still approaching the mainland, but was now on a costly diagonal. That navigator wanted her to turn right, but she would not do that. Instead, she moved straight on again, but stopped the artificial limp. A spasm of coughing shook her, and she spat bright red into the snow. 10 minutes later, the gray was now deep, indeed, and she found herself in the weird twilight of a heavy snowstorm. She fell again, tried to get up, failed at first, and finally managed to gain her feet. She stood, swaying, in the snow, barely able to remain upright in the wind. Waves of faintness rushing through her head, making her feel alternately heavy and light. Perhaps not all the roaring she heard in her ears was the wind, but it surely was the wind that finally succeeded in prying Alden's hat from her head. She made a grab for it, but the wind danced it easily out of her reach, and she saw it only for a moment, flipping gaily over and over into the darkening gray, a bright spot of orange. It struck the snow, rolled, rose again, was gone. Now her hair flew around her head freely. "It's all right, Stella," Bill said. "You can wear mine." She gasped and looked around in the white. Her gloved hands had gone instinctively to her bosom, and she felt sharp fingernails scratch at her heart. She saw nothing but shifting membranes of snow. And then, moving out of that evening's gray throat, the wind screaming through it like the voice of a devil in a snowy tunnel, came her husband, He was at first only moving colors in the snow. Red, black, dark green, lighter green. Then these colors resolved themselves into a flannel jacket with a flapping collar, flannel pants, and green boots. He was holding his hat out to her in a gesture that appeared almost absurdly courtly, and his face was Bill's face, unmarked by the cancer that had taken him. Had that been all she was afraid of? That a wasted shadow of her husband would come to her, a scrawny concentration camp figure with the skin pulled taut and shiny over the cheekbones and the eyes sunken deep in the sockets? And she felt a surge of relief. "Bill, is that really you?"
"Course."
"Bill," she said again, and took a glad step toward him. Her legs betrayed her, and she thought she would fall right through him. He was, after all, a ghost. But he caught her, in arms as strong and as competent as those that had carried her over the threshold of the house that she had shared only with Alden in these latter years. He supported her, and a moment later she felt the cap pulled firmly onto her head.
"Is it really you?"
she asked again, looking up into his face, at the crow's feet around his eyes which hadn't sunk deep yet, at the spill of snow on the shoulders of his checked hunting jacket, at his lively brown hair.
"It's me," he said. "It's all of us."
He half turned with her, and she saw the others coming out of the snow that the wind drove across the reach in the gathering darkness. A cry, half joy, half fear, came from her mouth as she saw Madeline Stoddard, Hattie's mother, in a blue dress that swung in the wind like a bell. And holding her hand was Hattie's dad, not a moldering skeleton somewhere on the bottom with the dancer, but whole and young. And there, behind those two,
"Annabelle!" she cried. "Annabelle Frayne, is it you?"
It was Annabelle. Even in the snowy gloom, Stella recognized the yellow dress Annabelle had worn to Stella's own wedding, and as she struggled toward her dead friend, holding Bill's arm, she thought that she could smell roses.
"Annabelle!"
"We're almost there now, dear," Annabelle said, taking her other arm.
The yellow dress, which had been considered daring in its day, but to Annabelle's credit and to everyone else's relief, not quite a scandal, left her shoulders bare. But Annabelle did not seem to feel the cold. Her hair a soft, dark auburn blew long in the wind.
"Only a little further."
She took Stella's other arm, and they moved forward again. Other figures came out of the snowy night, for it was night now. Stella recognized many of them, but not all. Tommy Frayne had joined Annabelle. Big George Havelock, who had died a dog's death in the woods, walked behind Bill. There was the fellow who had kept the lighthouse on the head for most of 20 years, and who used to come over to the island during the cribbage tournament Freddie Dinsmore held every February. Stella could almost, but not quite, remember his name. And there was Freddie himself. Walking off to one side of Freddie by himself and looking bewildered was Russell Bowie.
"Look, Stella," Bill said, and she saw black rising out of the gloom like the splintered prows of many ships.
It was not ships, it was split and fissured rock. They had reached the head. They had crossed the reach. She heard voices, but was not sure they actually spoke.
"Take my hand, Stella, do you?
Take my hand, Bill.
Oh, do you?
Annabelle, Freddy, Russell, John, Eddie... Frank, take my hand, do you love?"
"Will you take my hand, Stella?" a new voice asked.
She looked around, and there was Bull Symes. He was smiling kindly at her, and yet she felt a kind of terror in her at what was in his eyes, and for a moment she drew away, clutching Bill's hand on her other side the tighter.
"Is it time?" Bull asked.
"Oh, yeah, Stella, I guess so, but it don't hurt. At least I never heard so. All that's before."
She burst into tears suddenly, all the tears she had never wept, and put her hand in Bull's hand.
"Yes," she said. "Yes, I will. Yes, I did. Yes, I do. They stood in a circle in the storm, the dead of Goat Island, and the wind screamed around them, driving its packet of snow, and some kind of song burst from her. It went up into the wind, and the wind carried it away. They all sang then as children will sing in their high, sweet voices as a summer evening draws down to summer night. They sang, and Stella felt herself going to them and with them, finally across the reach. There was a bit of pain, but not much. Losing her maiden had it been worse. They stood in a circle in the night. The snow blew around them, and they sang. They sang, and Alden could not tell David and Lois, but in the summer after Stella died, when the children came out for their annual 2 weeks, he told Lona and Hal. He told them that during the great storms of winter, the wind seems to sing with almost human voices, and that sometimes it seemed to him he could almost make out the words, "Praise God, from whom all blessings flow. Praise Him, ye creatures here below." But he did not tell them. Imagine slow, unimaginative Alden Flanders saying such things aloud, even to the children, that sometimes he would hear that sound and feel cold, even by the stove, that he would put his whittling aside or the trap he had meant to mend, thinking that the wind sang in all the voices of those who were dead and gone, that they stood somewhere out on the reach and sang as children do. He seemed to hear their voices, and on these nights he sometimes slept and dreamed that he was singing the doxology, unseen and unheard, at his own funeral. There are things that can never be told, and there are things not exactly secret that are not discussed. They had found Stella frozen to death on the mainland a day after the storm had blown itself out. She was sitting on a natural chair of rock, about 100 yards south of the Raccoon Head town limits, frozen, just as neat as you please. The doctor who owned the corvette said that he was frankly amazed. It would have been a walk of over 4 miles, and the autopsy required by law in the case of an unattended, unusual death had shown an advanced cancerous condition. In truth, the old woman had been riddled with it. Was Alden to tell David and Lois that the cap on her head had not been his? Larry McKean had recognized that cap. So had John Benson. He had seen it in their eyes, and he supposed they had seen it in his. He had not lived long enough to forget his dead father's cap, the look of its bill, or the places where the visor had been broken. "These are things made for thinking on slowly," he would have told the children if he had known how. "Things to be thought on at length, while the hands do their work and the coffee sits in a solid china mug nearby. They are questions of reach, maybe. Do the dead sing? And do they love the living?" On the nights after Lona and Hal had gone back with their parents to the mainland in Al Curry's boat, the children standing astern and waving goodbye, Alden considered that question, and others, and the matter of his dead father's cap. Do the dead sing? Do they love? On those long nights alone, with his mother Stella Flanders at long last in her grave, it often seemed to Alden that they did both.
The following are the author's notes.
Not everyone is interested in where short stories come from, and that is perfectly proper. You don't have to understand the internal combustion engine to drive a car, and you don't need to know the circumstances which surrounded the making of a story to get a bit of pleasure from it. Engines interest mechanics. The creation of stories interests academics, fans, and snoops. The first and the last are almost synonymous, but never mind. I've included a few notes here on a few of the stories. such things as I thought might interest the casual reader, but if you're even more casual than that, I assure you that you can close the book without a qualm. You won't be missing much. The Mist. This was written in the summer of 1976 for an anthology of new stories being put together by my agent, Kirby McCauley. McCauley had created another book of this sort called Frights, 2 or 3 years previous. That book was a paperback. This one was to be a hardcover and much more ambitious in scope. It was called Dark Forces. Kirby wanted a story from me, and he pursued that story with doggedness, determination, and a kind of gentle diplomacy that is, I think, the hallmark of a really good agent. I couldn't think of a thing. The harder I thought, the more easily nothing came. I began to think that maybe the short story machine in my head was temporarily or permanently broken. Then came the storm, which was much as described in this story. At the height of it, there was indeed a waterspout on Long Lake in Bridgeton, where we were living at the time, and I did insist that my family come downstairs with me for a while, although my wife's name is Tabitha. Stephanie is her sister's name. The trip to the market the next day was also much as described in the story, although I was spared the company of such an odious creature as Norton. In the real world, the people living in Norton's summer cottage were a very pleasant doctor, Ralph Drews, and his wife. In the market, my muse suddenly shat on my head. This happened, as it always does, suddenly, with no warning. I was halfway down the middle aisle looking for hot dog buns when I imagined a big prehistoric bird flapping its way toward the meat counter at the back, knocking over cans of pineapple chunks and bottles of tomato sauce. By the time my son Joe and I were in the checkout lane, I was amusing myself with a story about all these people trapped in a supermarket surrounded by prehistoric animals. I thought it was wildly funny. What the Alamo would have been like if directed by Bert I. Gordon. I wrote half the story that night and the rest the following week. It got a little long, but Kirby thought it was good, and it went into the book. I never liked it that much until the rewrite. I particularly didn't like David Drayton sleeping with Amanda and then never finding out what happened to his wife. That seemed cowardly to me. But in the rewrite, I discovered a rhythm of language that I liked. And keeping that rhythm in mind, I was able to peel the story down to its basics more successfully than with some of my other long stories. Apt Pupil in Different Seasons is a particularly good example of this disease I have. Literary elephantiasis. The real key to this rhythm lay in the deliberate use of the story's first line, "This is what happened," which I simply stole from Douglas Fairbairn's brilliant novel, Shoot. The line is, for me, the essence of all story, a kind of Zen incantation. I must tell you that I also like the metaphor implied in David Drayton's discovery of his own limitations. And I like the story's cheery cheesiness. You're supposed to see this one in black and white, with your arm around your girl's shoulders or your guy's, and a big speaker stuck in the window. You make up the second feature. Here There Be Tigers. My first grade teacher in Stratford, Connecticut, was Mrs. Van Buren. She was pretty scary. I guess if a tiger had come along and eaten her up, I could have gotten behind that. You know how kids are. The Monkey. I was in New York City on business about 4 years ago. I was walking back to my hotel after visiting my people at New American Library when I saw a guy selling wind-up monkeys on the street. There was a platoon of them standing on a gray blanket he'd spread on the sidewalk at the corner of 5th and 44th, all bending and grinning and clapping their cymbals. They looked really scary to me, and I spent the rest of my walk back to the hotel wondering why. I decided it was because they reminded me of the lady with the shears, the one who cuts everyone's thread one day. So, keeping that idea in mind, I wrote the story, mostly longhand, in a hotel room. Mrs. Todd's Shortcut. My wife is the real Mrs. Todd. The woman really is mad for a shortcut, and much of the one in the story actually exists. She found it, too. And Tabby really does seem to be getting younger sometimes. Although I hope I am not like Worth Todd, I try not to be. I like this story a lot. It tickles me. And the old guy's voice is soothing. Every now and then you write something that brings back the old days, when everything you wrote seemed fresh and full of invention. Mrs. Todd felt that way to me when I was writing it. One final note on it. 3 women's magazines turned it down. 2 because of that line about how a woman will pee down her own leg if she doesn't squat. They apparently felt that either women don't pee or don't want to be reminded of the fact. The third magazine to reject it, Cosmopolitan, did so because they felt the main character was too old to interest their target audience. No comment. Except to add that Red Book finally took it, God bless them. The Jaunt, this was originally for Omni, which quite rightly rejected it because the science is so wonky. It was Ben Bova's idea to have the colonists in the story mining for water, and I have incorporated that in this version. The Raft. I wrote this story in the year 1968 as The Float. In late 1969, I sold it to Adam Magazine, which, like most of the girly magazines, paid not on acceptance, but only on publication. The amount promised was $250. In the spring of 1970, while creeping home in my white Ford station wagon from the University Motor Inn at 12:30 in the morning, I ran over a number of traffic cones, which were guarding a crosswalk that had been painted that day. The paint had dried, but no one had bothered to take the cones in when it got dark. One of them bounced up and knocked my muffler loose from the rotted remains of my tailpipe. I was immediately suffused with a sort of towering, righteous rage which only drunk undergraduates can feel. I decided to circle the town of Orono, picking up traffic cones. I would leave them all in front of the police station the next morning with a note saying that I had saved numerous mufflers and exhaust systems from extinction and ought to get a medal. I got about 150 before blue lights started to swirl around in the rearview mirror. I will never forget the Orono cop turning to me after a long, long look into the back of my station wagon and asking, "Son, are those traffic cones yours?" The cones were confiscated, and so was I. That night I was a guest of the town of Orono, that crossword puzzle favorite. A month or so later, I was brought to trial in Bangor District Court on a charge of petty larceny. I was my own attorney, and did indeed have a fool for a client. I was fined $250, which I, of course, did not have. I was given 7 days to come up with it, or do 30 more days as a guest of Penobscot County. I probably could have borrowed it from my mother, but the circumstances were not easy to understand, unless you had a skinful of booze, that was. Although one is now not supposed to ever use a deus ex machina in his or her fiction because these gods from the machine are not believable, I notice that they arrive all the time in real life. Mine came 3 days after the judge levied my fine and arrived in the form of a check from Adam Magazine for $250. It was for my story, The Float. It was like having someone send you a real get-out-of-jail-free card. I cashed the check immediately and paid my fine. I determined to go straight, and give all traffic cones a wide berth thereafter. Straight I have not exactly gone, but believe me when I tell you I'm quits with the cones. But here's the thing. Adam paid only on publication, damn it, and since I got the money the story must have come out. But no copy was ever sent to me, and I never saw one on the stands. Although I checked regularly, I would simply push my way in between the dirty old men, checking out such literary pinnacles as Boobs and Buns and Spanking Lesbians, and thumb through every magazine the Knight Publishing Company put out. I never saw that story in any of them. Somewhere along the way, I lost the original manuscript, too. I got to thinking about the story again in 1981, some 13 years later. I was in Pittsburgh, where the final Creepshow editing was going on, and I was bored. So I decided to have a go at recreating that story, and the result was The Raft. It is the same as the original in terms of event, but I believe it is far more gruesome in its specifics. Anyway, if anyone out there has ever seen The Float, or even if someone has a copy, could you send me a Xerox copy or something? Even a postcard confirming the fact that I'm not crazy? It would have been an Adam, or Adam Quarterly, or most likely Adam Bedside Reader. Not much of a name, I know, but in those days I only had 2 pairs of pants and 3 pairs of underwear. And beggars can't be choosers, and it was a lot better than Spanking Lesbians, let me tell you. I'd just like to make sure it was published someplace other than the Dead Zone. Survivor type. I got to thinking about cannibalism one day, because that's the sort of thing guys like me sometimes think about. And my muse once more evacuated its magic bowels on my head. I know how gross that sounds, but it's the best metaphor I know, inelegant or not, and believe me when I tell you I'd give that little fornit X-lax if he wanted it. Anyway, I started to wonder if a person could eat himself. And if so, how much he could eat, before the inevitable happened. This idea was so utterly and perfectly revolting that I was too overawed with delight to do more than think about it for days. I was reluctant to write it down, because I thought I could only fuck it up. Finally, when my wife asked me what I was laughing at one day when we were eating hamburgers on the back deck, I decided I ought to at least take it for a test drive. We were living in Bridgeton at the time, and I spent an hour or so talking with Ralph Drews, the retired doctor next door. Although he looked doubtful, at first, the year before, in pursuit of another story, I had asked him if he thought it was possible for a man to swallow a cat, he finally agreed that a guy could subsist on himself for quite a while. Like everything else, which is material, he pointed out, the human body is just stored energy. Ah, I asked him, but what about the repeated shock of the amputations? The answer he gave me is, with very few changes, the first paragraph of the story. I guess Faulkner never would have written anything like this, huh? Oh, well. Uncle Otto's truck. The truck is real, and so is the house. I made up the story that goes around him one day in my head on a long drive to pass the time. I liked it, and so I took a few days to write it down. The Reach. Tabby's youngest brother, Tommy, used to be in the Coast Guard. He was stationed down east in the Jonesport Beals area of the long and knotty Maine coast, where the guards' main chores are changing the batteries in the big buoys and saving idiot drug smugglers who get lost in the fog or run on the rocks. There are lots of islands out there and lots of tightly knit island communities. He told me of a real-life counterpart of Stella Flanders who lived and died on her island. Was it Pig Island? Cow Island? I can't remember. Some animal, anyway. I could hardly believe it. She didn't ever want to come across to the mainland, I asked. No, she said she didn't want to cross the reach until she died, Tommy said. The term reach was unfamiliar to me, and Tommy explained it. He also told me the lobstermen's joke about how it's a mighty long reach between Jonesport and London, and I put it in the story. It was originally published in Yankee as Do the Dead Sing, a nice enough title, but after some thought I have gone back to the original title here. Well, that's it. I don't know about you, but every time I come to the end, it's like waking up. It's a little sad to lose the dream, but everything all around, the real stuff, looks damn good just the same. Thanks for coming along with me. I enjoyed it. I always do. I hope you arrived safe, and that you'll come again. Because, as that funny butler says in that odd New York club, there are always more tales. Stephen King, Bangor, Maine.